This podcast is brought to you by Random House Audio. Experience books like you've never heard them before. Press play.
T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
We can confirm.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Welcome to Weekend Confirmed, everybody. My name is Garnet Lee, and we have an excellent show coming up for you, so we will waste no time getting into it. The esteemed Mr. Ryan Payton is here today.
Oh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Whose game you may have seen announced, finally. Are you excited?
Thrilled? Tired, but yeah, excited.
You really should watch the pre-show video because Ryan does look like he is an extra out of Silent Hill or something. He's just sort of hanging on.
HD collection?
HD collection, yes.
Or not.
No, pre-patch HD collection.
Oh yeah, that's how I feel right now. No, but it's just weird to know that people are, like, that you guys know about the game, right? That people are talking about the game.
Is it pronounced Republic?
Yeah, I just read it's Republic.
Because it's spelled
Republique.
Yeah,
it's like Diabolique.
Yeah. Right.
Republique. And of course, coming from Camouflage, this now has set the precedent that all of your products and projects from now on must be, you know,
hooked on phonics.
Yes, exactly. So we also have the two Jeffs here. Jeff Cannata back from his vacation.
Very happy to be
sojourn.
Back. Sojourn. Yes. And I want to just quickly thank everybody who came out to see Double Jump. I hope Christian thanked everybody last week as well.
No, you told him to piss off.
That guy's a douchebag.
He is sort of a douchebag.
But I would like to thank everybody and say that we have another one. So if you missed the first one or if you want to come see it again, April 28th, UCB Theater, midnight, be there. It was sold out last time. Get your tickets early.
Yeah, not only sold out, but you guys did wind up ultimately having to turn a few people away from the will call window.
We did.
It was a shame.
If you want the link to buy tickets, you can follow me at Jeff Cannata with two N's and one T.
And Jeff, or I'm sorry, Indie Jeff. Sorry, I was going to call you Jeff Mattis, but I'll go back to Indie Jeff.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, everybody. How's it going?
So, and you now have fans. Did you see that? You have fans on the message board.
They've always had fans.
I love you guys. Thank you for the positive feedback.
Because you don't interrupt. So remember, be quiet and sit down there and shut up.
Okay.
Oh.
All right. Shutting up now.
That's why you have no fans, Garnet.
We're going to have a little fun. Hey, so we got all kinds of things to talk about. We are definitely going to talk about Ryan's new game, which is coming out. When is it coming out? You're about to Kickstarter it, right?
Yeah, we're going
to
Kickstarter it. Because, as my uncle calls it, jumpstart it.
Oh, you're going to jumpstart it.
Yeah. He's like, I'll be checking out you on jumpstart.com next week. So.
Awesome. Did you guys see the awesome comedian who was doing a Kickstarter campaign to buy Kickstarter? Isn't that brilliant?
That's awesome. If it works, it's even
as well, just intellectually, it's brilliant.
So we got that. Ryan also wants to bring back one of our favorite games for discussion, Dark Souls, because that's actually all he plays. The real reason he has bags under his eyes is not working on the game. He's been playing Dark Souls, and he can't put it down.
No.
We've got news. We have Jeff, who's checked out some Borderlands 2. We have Jeff Mattis, who's finished Mass Effect 3, and we're going to talk about that right off the bat because we're going to talk about some of the ending stuff with the extended cut. What do you guys think about this thing? Extended cut. So, by the way, here, why don't I fill in the blanks? So, if anyone's listening hasn't heard yet, extended cut was announced by BioWare and EA. It's downloadable content coming out this summer to address the complaints folks have had with the ending. It will, as they put it, give fans
Fecal matter?
No, I did not say fecal matter. You did.
I did.
It will give fans seeking further clarity to the ending deeper insights into how their personal journey concludes. This is going to be through additional cinematic sequences and epilogue scenes.
So it's not a new ending.
No, it is not a new ending.
It is an extended ending of what we already got.
They were crystal clear about that piece, which is good. Dr. Ray said, since launch, we've had time to listen to feedback from our most passionate fans and are responding. With the Mass Effect 3 extended cut, we think we have struck a good balance in delivering the answers players are looking for while maintaining the team's artistic vision for the end of the story arc in the Mass Effect universe. So, first of all, the way they're terming it, obviously, they're steering clear of even talking about playable.
Are we going to talk about this with spoilers intact or not without spoilers?
We're going to talk about this with spoilers intact. We're at the beginning of the show. Let's not spoil the ending for folks.
Oh, so spoilers not
intact.
I don't even know
intact
what spoilers
was the wrong
intact
word.
Means.
We are going to continue to respect.
We are not employing spoilers in this discussion.
We will not be. I mean, I think we can be a little looser with it than we've been in prior times, but let's not just spell out the ending piece. I mean, and certainly there's plenty to talk about here. I mean, right off the bat, some of the responses that we got on the Shaq News was from, That's a weird pronunciation. People with forum names that are like weird combinations of vowels.
Did you say forum or foreign?
Forum.
Okay.
That's what I thought. Forum. It's foreign names.
These damn foreigners.
What a difference a letter makes. Yes.
Forum.
Yeah.
Not Santorum. Arcane. Oh, that's what it's supposed to be. Arcane, but he's spelled it R-A-R-C-E-I-H-N.
This is fascinating radio.
Anyway, I finally phonetics. Wait, you're the one with camouflage. Flagy.
With
the flag.
Spelled with a J.
Yeah. One of the biggest ones issues, the lack of character closure is absolutely reparable. So do you guys agree that this could repair the ending here?
Well, it's difficult to, I mean,
well,
Jeff, go ahead.
No, this is a subject that I don't, having finished the game last night, it's hard to touch this with a 10-foot pole and not piss somebody off. My experience with the end without.
You pissed me off.
Yeah, I know.
Bastard.
Without going into too much detail is, granted, I did do a lot of, you know, I tend to wander the ship in between missions and talk to everyone to see if there's any new dialogue that triggers and stuff. So in doing that, in going through my natural gameplay patterns, I actually got a lot of the closure that I wanted to get. It wasn't like everything was packaged up in a nice little bow, but in terms of all the characters and the character-character relationship with Shepard, I felt a lot of those were, you know, had their sort of little wrap-up moment, you know, where...
Through walking around the ship, because the wrap-up moment was really more that like, walk of shame at the end. You're like...
when you're meeting everybody right before the big war? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's like, oh, I just slept with this girl, now I gotta leave the dorm house. Oh, damn it. Gonna walk past everybody. Oh, shit, everybody's gonna have something to say.
Wait, who is your romance option?
I think he was being metaphorical about the walk of shame.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was being metaphorical. But actually...
Yeah, that happens at the end, right? I mean...
It does happen at the end. And I thought that was one of the weaknesses of the ending, was how mechanical it became after so much of the game, your interaction with all the characters being much more narrative-like, in that, you know, they're always good at staging the times that you spend time in conversation. So if I'm going to have a dialogue... moment with Jeff, then it's in a specific spot. They've controlled the camera. It has a much more filmic sort of expression to it. And then they get to the end of the game and it's like, oh, here are people who are like statues, like a colonnade. I'm walking down the colonnade to the ending and stopping at each column and admiring it and going, oh, this is a beautiful column.
What do you think about me?
Let me read the placard at the base of this column and have my little explanation about what I'm supposed to know now.
But that's pretty consistent with Mass Effect.
Yeah.
That's pretty consistent with what they've done in the past in endings of like, yeah, here's everything that we're going
to... You're about to embark on the final mission for which there is no return. Are you sure? Like, do you really want to end the game now?
Here's info dump.
Go talk to everyone first.
Okay, so rather than us sitting here and pontificating about this, which we've done before, you know, to death, Ryan has worked Ryan's worked on games. What's the biggest challenge if you're trying to wrap up narrative at the end of a game and still keep a gamer like playing the game and engaged in it, but still give them a good narrative experience, as opposed to just like, oh God, I got to give you this museum display where I just pressed the button for the explanation of the exhibit I'm looking at?
So I think the key to success with a good ending is that you have these sub teams. One that's creating, like, if you're doing like a stealth action game, just for as an example, you have a small team that's doing like a fighting game, and then you have another small team that's doing like a mech battle, and then you have another small team that's doing some other crazy stuff, and then you just throw that all at the end and then just like blow everybody away.
Awesome. Best answer ever.
But actually, jokes aside, like my perspective on this is very different.
QTE, right? That's the
best answer ever.
But then maybe take him to the cemetery.
Maybe bring back a surprise character at the end with a fake ending and fake credit roll.
Awesome, that's a good idea.
Just throw that in there. Good.
You know what's also fun? Weddings.
No.
Weddings are fun.
No, now you went too far. No.
And sometimes
monkeys and diapers. Right?
It's only a dream. Sometimes you know you wake up.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. People love it when you do it that way.
Every game.
Now, no, but my perspective on this is very different. One is that I'm maybe 5-10 hours into Mass Effect 3. I just haven't really had the time to play into the game. But I'm a huge Mass Effect nerd. But all like Mass Effect aside, I actually just love the fact that people are upset about the ending that I don't know anything about, but that people are actually talking about the game ending, because that means that a lot of people got to the ending on a long game like that. Because I have seen stats of blockbuster games.
And oh, yeah.
The percentage of people that are finishing these games are very low. So maybe this is even encouraging people to check out what was happening.
I think that's absolutely the case. My theory is, and this isn't to discount anyone's legitimate gripes, my theory is a lot of the people that kind of leapt on the bandwagon of criticizing the ending hadn't finished it. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it probably encouraged a lot of people to finish it to see what all the hubbub was about. And that's cool. I think that's very cool. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a tough thing. Obviously, it's a tough thing to end any piece of fiction in any medium, satisfyingly. But I've been doing, you know, I did a lot of reading about the indoctrination theory. Did you guys, anybody read that?
I read a little cursory reading. But
it's pretty interesting to me. I think it reminds me of people like with Lost and with The Matrix, when people are heavily invested in something. And even Star Wars. Star Wars is a great example of this, actually. When people are heavily invested in something and it kind of doesn't meet their expectations, they pick up the mantle and do all the work to sort of retroactively
make things fit,
retcon their expectations. And there's a lot of evidence, actually, that this whole indoctrination thing is kind of legit. There's a lot of weird clues that
are
thrown
in. You could also slaughter a goat and go through the entrails and figure out the future of the world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong in the sense that, as I said, there's a lot of that sort of, I'm going to do all the work for them to put it together and make it not underwhelming.
I'm going to build on what you're talking about in that I think what's cool about it is that people were so engaged and so interested that they spent this time to pour over it to such a micro degree to be able to pull these pieces out and connect them in a at least reasonable enough manner that you could say, I can construct a argument for why this is what happened, and here's how it all lays together with marker points along the way drawn strictly out of the source material without really messing it up.
It reminds me of the doing the Kessel run in 12 parsecs, and people are like, wait, what the fuck? A parsec isn't a length of time. It's a, how the hell? And then somebody was like, no, here's what George Lucas was talking about. He was going so fast that he could, that he did it in, used gravity to slingshot, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, no, he was pulling a fucking spacey sounding word out of his ass.
Probably.
But it's awesome that you then, explained that away. So I think there's some of that happening for sure.
But Ryan, while you joked about it, and if it's too hard a question or not one that you want to touch, that's cool too. But like, if you get to the end, and I really wasn't hinting at Metal Gear. I was just asking
for general experience. I brought that to the table.
I'm like, how hard is it to pull all this stuff together? I mean, games are by their very nature something we play. And so when you're in the process of the journey, so to say, of the game, you're playing the game, you have the player engaged, and there's a back and forth and a rhythm and a pace. But then you get to the ending and everybody knows, hey, by the way, this is going to be the end. I'm going to set the controller down. I'm going to be done. And I also need to have the narrative closure piece that before so much of it had been delivered through the experience playing the control, playing with the controller or doing something in the game.
For a second time in a row, I'm not going to answer your question directly because I think I think Mass Effect is very different in that there's so many different loose ends and bringing those together. And I haven't worked on a game like that. I've worked on, two big games that have very linear paths towards the end. I think the challenge with a lot of video game endings is that you feel this need to have something special, not only for a cinematic or some kind of story moment at the end, but also for gameplay, right? So if your game is 95% shooting dudes in the face, you feel like the need that you can't just end on that, right? Because that's what the people have been doing the entire game. That you have to have some kind of special thing. And a lot of games falter
there. Yeah.
A lot of games fall down there, and it's really difficult to do.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you play, and then at the end you're like, oh, all the rules are different for this one moment, because it needs to be quote unquote special, but it feels less than, because I come back to the games that whose endings I love, like the first Halo. Well, that is kind of a different thing where you're still driving the Warthog
Warthog. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
But and then Halo Reach was another great one where the ending is
Deus Ex.
The original Deus Ex is another great example. You're doing what you did, but the stakes are higher, and you feel the climax of the narrative, but it's not because you're doing something that's wildly different from what you've been doing.
And I also think that oftentimes reconciling the narrative, like the story you're trying to tell with your gameplay, is nigh impossible because mm-hmm. you're trying to tell a story that's way more involved and has way more facets and emotional levels than, like you mm-hmm. said, running around shooting people in the face. And so you get to the end and you're like, okay, gameplay payoff. And then it's almost like they're two separate things.
And I think
like
that's the core problem of video game narrative is that yeah. the core gameplay that you're doing and then the story that they're trying to tell are often so far disconnected. Like, right. you go back to Call of Duty as an example, like it's a story of like this worldwide terrorism and things like that. But at the core of what you're doing is moving a cursor around and shooting somebody. How do you link that with this global terrorism threat?
Yeah.
Right.
It's kind of nonsensical.
It's almost impossible. Yeah.
Well, and if you want to go into the fiction of it even a little bit, all you're doing is running down the streets of a city, gunning down random terrorist lackey number 27, which yeah. really, like, that's not going to stop global terrorism. Eventually, you might get to, you know, the node where something's happening and be able to defuse something. But I see what you're saying.
And that's not to say that there's not good examples. I actually think Call of Duty has one of the better, more, in terms of gameplay, like, kind of exciting endings. I think, like, for example, Modern Warfare 2, I thought had a really cool ending. And in the first Modern Warfare as well. And then, like, Portal 2, I thought had an awesome
ending.
Like
the Modern Warfare 2 ending?
Yeah.
On the bridge?
No, that was, wasn't that one?
That was one?
Yeah. One is the bridge, I think, yeah. And then you wake up at the beginning of two after the bridge.
And then two is that
we're spoiling all of them.
Yeah. You know, that's hysterical, though. Games, nobody can... They're all the same.
And they're all continuations.
Like,
I mean,
which one was two?
In our defense, they are continuations of the same.
True.
They almost pick up.
With Ghost?
Yeah.
You know, and they had like the speedboat, and you're going down there, and then there's a final moment.
Right. It was the 50 Cent ending.
Yeah,
it was the 50 Cent ending.
Yeah,
it was the 50 Cent ending.
All right, fine. It was the 50 Cent ending.
It was the 50 Cent ending. Well, Blood in the Sand ending.
Right.
I forgot. Yeah, that's
high art game I heard on the show at one point.
But in passing, you sort of
I liked it. It was fun.
In passing, you brought up Portal 2, which I still think has one of the best endings I've ever played.
Absolutely.
And it's because this concept that was introduced to you that you had to learn in order to progress through the game, you then applied in a completely new and grander way than you had ever applied it through the course of the game.
That's why puzzle games, I think, have a leg up in doing that.
Yeah.
Because you're introducing progressive mechanics and you're getting to the point where you're teaching. Okay, let the reins loose.
Yeah.
You know, it's use your tools. Yeah.
So wrapping up the idea of Extended Cup,
Well, we never even really talked about that.
Which will be out this summer.
Is there a point? Is there
going to be free?
A way to just add a little bit on the end that will make everyone happy?
So
I don't think so.
That was going to be my question. Is this thing's going to be, you know, it sounds like just more exposition. They talk about epilogue scenes and cinematics.
It's just a text crawl.
Wait, when does Entitlement Edition come out?
That was Jeff Mattis.
I guess it was.
At Jeff Mattis.
Yeah. This summer, Twitter. Free DLC, all three platforms. What's your perspective on its success potential?
What exactly happens when you download this DLC? Do you have to then finish the game again, or do you? Is
that's
it
a great
just like
question.
Pop it in and it goes?
Because
here's
after
the end.
That's an excellent question because after you finish the game, it takes you back prior to that final leg.
Yeah.
On the Normandy.
Do you
that's
click
a great
a
question. What does it do?
View additional ending bits,
or do you have to play through that garbage again?
I have a question.
Yes.
As a kind of a conspiracy theory nut. You saw the news about, was it the consumerist?
Yes.
In the poll about...
I was going to avoid that because I think the whole topic is silly, as I sort of talked about on Twitter.
Let me link it to the Mass Effect controversy. Do
oh,
you
God.
Think that the votes that they got as far as worst company in the world had to do with people being upset about the Mass Effect 3? That was part of the community. Because, like, how the hell do they lose to Bank of America?
No. That's absolutely what it was.
I think you can draw a one-to-one there. But I think that there's also a baseline... ill will towards EA for cranking out sports franchises year over year, for Project $10, for, you know, like feeling like they throw games out the door and don't care about them like Syndicate. And I think that there's just this baseline sort of, oh, EA is not maybe as bad guy evil as I think people project onto like an Activision at times,
mm-hmm.
but like definitely a sort of, yeah, we really don't like those guys. And then the Mass Effect thing makes you upset and you start punching. You're like, I'm going to go punch that button a bunch of times on the internet.
I'm surprised by that, like the whole thing.
I was surprised by it as well.
And I, because I remember there was a lot of EA hate, I would say maybe in 2005, 2006. And I thought they brought it around with like bringing out cool games like Dead Space and Mirror's Edge. And all of a sudden they were a cool company again, right? And then
I think it's only partial. I think they sort of exist in this weird world where they can do something that's cool on a case by case basis, but that as an institution, people still sort of look at them as a as a monolithic bad guy, evil corporation sort of front.
Well, thing. What's a big monolithic corporation
that people do like?
That people do like
Apple.
Right, but yeah. We, I mean, pre-show we were bitching about them too.
Oh yeah, we can bitch about them, but I mean, it is one that
people love that company.
I mean, they love them so much that Instagram for Android comes out, and the iPhone people are like, stay off our Instagram. You're gonna ruin it for everybody.
Well, okay, yeah.
That was crazy. I totally didn't get that. And the thing about since we brought up the subject, the thing about the worst company in America piece that I tried to bring up on Twitter that got a little misinterpreted is that I think that there was this immediate backlash of gamers, first of all, who felt defensive about why is a game company, like why is our hobby being demonized again, and especially compared to, you know, corporations like Bank of America that was involved in the freaking banking scandal, which is this huge, obviously several-fold larger societal issue. And my response to that is, slow down for a second. You're talking about a web poll. It's not scientific.
Right.
It's very emotional. It's very spur of the moment. It's not scientific. And on top of that, I think that there's still a undercurrent of, hey, we go to the internet for our hobbies and our entertainment and our likes and dislikes. We don't go there for real serious political discussion. We don't go there for things that we're going to have like a serious.
Some people do.
Some people do. Some people do, clearly. But even an outlet such as the Huffington Post is still as much.
Yeah, don't read the comments there or anywhere.
Exactly. And so that was my point, is you just sort of have to take this thing for what it's worth. And my original comment was, folks who are in charge of brands, especially entertainment brands, you should be really aware of paying attention to how quickly these sentiments move on you and how much that volume can get turned up really fast.
But it's mercurial.
Of the moment today, a bunch of people really did look at that and say, I'm more pissed off about Mass Effect 3 than I am about the banking scandal, and I'm punching EA.
That's because people give a shit about video games, and sadly, they don't give a shit about lots of other things.
But they get in the moment, and they get upset, and that's how big that passion is. And my point was for folks who are, you know, marketing and doing that sort of thing, is that, hey, you got to think about this stuff. Anyway, there you go.
It's blowing up. It's not me. Somebody,
it might have been me.
It's probably Kanata. He never turns his damn phone off. He's bad about that.
Hey, it was me.
Of course it was you. He's proud of it. Sweet. He's like, I'm the guy disrupting the meeting. It's awesome.
Mr. Popular.
What do you think, Jeff Mattis, as far as potential for success for this thing? So, Kanata, you're kind of like,
I think it's going to be interesting to see what they do. I'm so curious what they can do with just a few scenes of, you know, where does it fit in there? Is it more like grandpa and son holding hands looking at the sky?
And I still have faith that what BioWare will put out will be cool. And I just don't know, like, having finished it, and I've only seen one ending, and you know, it was a pretty good ending for me.
By the way, having seen all three, you've basically seen the nuts and bolts of all three.
Okay. So, like, in terms of the Shepard that I was playing, I felt like I got a good resolution. I'm not sure how much this extra stuff is really going to, for me personally, is really going to make a difference. It'll be cool. I'll happily watch it and, you know, see a few more moments with the characters that I love. But do I need it?
Yeah.
No.
So I'm not quite as cynical as Crimson Beak, who I had to bring in here because I love this comment. It says, I'm positive BioWare will just skirt the whole thing, not address the ending, and miss the entire point. Which is the entire Earth mission is shit and the entire space god bullshit. So I'm not quite that cynical about it, but I think that there's sort of a couple of things that apply here. The first of them being, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you really might get
more clarity. Oh, now we can't convince ourselves it was an indoctrination theory. You know, impossible.
Exactly. And I think that building on that, like, there's no real way after we've gotten this far down the road that you're really going to build satisfaction. I think that they honestly would have been better off to not been so vehement in their defense, just say, look, here it is, be done with it, and then go on with their plan. I mean, they had lots of great plans. And unfortunately, as Casey Hudson talked about, the executive producer in the game, they've even altered their production schedule to create this content, which means that future DLC, which would have been way more relevant and interesting if it had come out closer to the release of the game, is now going to be pushed back so that they could create this stuff, as opposed to, like, look, if I was going to buy DLC, which I'm not even saying I was going to, but if I was, it would have probably been in the next 3 months. And sometime after that, I'm going to be like, you know, fuck it. You know, because I've had a good Mass Effect experience.
Oh, I mean, with a game this long, I'd argue you could wait 6 months after release to release your first piece of DLC and have people that have, because people that are going to finish it are going to blaze through. It's going to be really hard to get them with, you know, unless it's day one DLC, it's going to be really hard to get them, you know, before they finish the game. And those people, like myself included, I'll probably play through it again.
Hmm. It'll be the most, one of the most talked about DLCs, I think.
It will.
Yeah, this one will, for sure. Absolutely.
Oh, no, this definitely will. Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm curious what got shelved for the time being in order to make space in the pipeline for them to do this. I don't know.
I want to go back real quick to what you said about seeing the data on how many people actually finish long AAA games. I mean, what are we talking?
Well, it really, I mean, obviously it depends on the game.
Sure.
But
there's that Red Dead report, right?
I think those numbers are inaccurate.
Well, they probably are. Anyway.
But I would say for like a high end, a really well known game, and these are honestly are not Microsoft numbers, but just kind of through friends in the industry, like a really high number would be like a 70-75%.
Oh, that's actually higher than I expected.
Which is why the Red Dead number is
those were
off.
Really low,
yeah. Right? But there are some big, big titles where they're, you know, 18%,
really,
21%. One in particular I know of, it was 8%.
Does it have anything to do, any correlation with length of the game, perhaps?
Like, oh yeah, absolutely. There's all that kind of stuff, right?
I'd love to know what the 8% one
is. So you're hooked on Dark Souls, which is a game that is very much about the playing of it as opposed to trying to reach the conclusion of it, I would say, to a big degree.
Yeah, you touched on exactly the one word that like really has me gravitate to this game, and I won't bore your listeners because I know that game came out back in October and it's kind of old news now, but it's that word is playing, right? Like I feel like I'm playing a game rather than being on a roller coaster, because I really feel like video games, especially like big budget games, have really moved away from like what Jeff likes to do with board games is sitting there and thinking about your next move, and like there's consequences to what I'm doing, and this is just like, I'm almost like I'm playing, it goes back to why I like video games from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And now I'm playing a lot of, you know, new games with big budgets where I don't feel like I'm playing so much as I'm experiencing it.
It's a theme park ride.
Right.
Yeah. So how much do you even care about hitting the end of Dark Souls?
Don't care. I'm still trying not to. I'm doing everything I possibly can in the game before I go and finish it.
Interesting.
And it's weird because I've been on one of the most hardcore crunches I've ever been in my life, even worse than MGS4's crunch with Camouflage right now. And I go home and I'm just exhausted. And the weird thing is, the only thing I want to go home and play and like do anything is just go out and play Dark Souls for an hour, which is really weird because it's a super stressful game.
Yeah, it is. You
know,
it is.
I'm this weird masochistic like gamer. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm playing PvP in Dark Souls. Like I'll just go on there. I'll drop one of the stones, invade somebody, or somebody will invade me, and we have a couple matches. And I just log off and I sleep for a few hours.
Do you skydive to unwind too? Like
I'm sorry,
skydive or bungee jump to unwind? Like,
yeah,
after
exactly.
No, right?
You know, studies have found that we're not spending enough time in boredom to recoup our creative juices. Just saying. I just read that report the other day on the internet. The boredom is healthy for our creative processes.
One of the games I was playing this week was
I didn't buy it either.
I know it's interesting. I actually think. Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all.
It's just something I think about all the time. Is like the balance between like the IO, like the input and output of like creativity, and how much I think as a society we take in too much and we don't put out enough. And maybe it's similar to what they're talking about, maybe completely different. And I really feel that way.
I think your brain needs downtime for sure.
It was a little simpler than that. But that's interesting too.
Anyway, one of the games
take us to the break, Mr. Cannata. Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say one of the games I've been playing this week, just very briefly, was the Devil May Cry HD Collection. And
I'm keen for that, at least for the first one.
Yeah, well, that's why I thought of it, is because it's so clear when you play when I was hopping like from 1 to 2 to 3 just to sort of get a flavor, see what they've done to them. It's so interesting how far games have come or what the huge changes are, because you jump into the first Devil May Cry and you're just wandering around with nothing to do for like the first 10 minutes of that game. And then by the time you're in Devil May Cry 3, the entire first mission is just, hey, bad guys are here, kill them, you know? And the first game is so much like Resident Evil, it really
Well, because it started off as Resident Evil.
Exactly. But it's very much puzzles, it's very much just let you be here in this place and not really give you any indication of what you're supposed to do, where you're supposed to go, what's happening. And games just don't allow themselves to do that anymore, except for Dark Souls, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not like the biggest defender of Dark Souls too, because I think they have some serious usability issues, serious problems. I think there's a great, like, if they could, you know what, I'm trying to get a hold of Miyazaki actually to talk to him, because I'm going to Japan in a couple weeks and I want to sit down and like convince him that you have like an amazing thing on your hands in terms of what you've discovered in terms of really great gameplay, but it is there is something you need to work on in terms of usability and allowing people to understand what the hell's going on. You shouldn't have to go on GAF into the massive thread that had tens of thousands of questions being asked and responses about how do I do these very simple things, right? Yeah. It's a serious issue with that game. And I think even for Devil May Cry, for the game that I'm working on right now, I'm not going to make it. So you just run around a room and try to figure out what happens. I mean, I'm going to lose people, right? But I still want to bring back that kind of that real sense of like risk and reward and consequences and having to plan and think about it. It's a lot of things that I really felt like when I was playing the first Resident Evil about I have this amount of ammo. Should I take down this zombie or should I run away from him? I love that. I love that.
How much of Dark Souls inaccessibility do you think has to do with like, I mean, it's love and the hardcore community has to do with its inaccessibility specifically because people are like, they want to get into a game that's like, I got to go to look at a wiki and.
Yeah, it's this really, really delicate balance. I think you're onto something. I think there's aspects of it which I love, and I don't want to spoil it, even though, I mean, it is 6 months old. But there's a way you can visit this bird who can give you these special items. And the way you go visit the bird is like this weird, bizarre path you have to take and do these different obtuse things. It really reminds me of like old school, like, did you know in this NES game, if you go jump here and then you do this thing and then you hear on the school playground and you don't believe it and you go try and it actually happened? That they have that kind of stuff. That's awesome, right? But then you hand the controller to somebody and they don't know how to swing. And like I think you have swing on right bumper and the D-pad menu is not really consistent, which actually is consistent, like which is mapped to the D-pad. There's lots of serious usability issues.
But remember that discovery is part of the joy of playing the game, Ryan.
That's what I'm talking about, the delicate balance, right? And it's right. I'm playing the argument
I know what you mean. That's the argument's made. And there is a degree of truth to that. There is a degree of truth to that. The reward for sticking around while we take this little break will be that you will get to hear all about, from the mouth of its creator, upcoming Republic. So stick around. Don't go anywhere. We Can Confirm. We'll be right back. This week's episode of We Can Confirm is brought to you by Random House Audio. Here's a sample of A Game of Thrones from book 2 in the series, A Clash of Kings by George R.R. Martin, read by Roy Dotrice.
The inn was burning, he saw. Black Lauren appeared beside him and stood silently for a time. The sun was low in the west, painting the fields and houses all a glowing red. A thin, wavering cry of pain drifted over the walls, and a war horn sounded off beyond the burning houses. Theon watched a wounded man drag himself painfully across the ground, smearing his life's blood in the dirt as he struggled to reach the well that stood at the center of the market square.
Visit www.randomhouseaudio.com to download something new. Very cool. Hope you will take advantage of another sponsorship opportunity for us.
Dude, I gotta say, Roy Dotrice is one of the greatest audiobook readers you will ever encounter. He does phenomenal work. And if you want to be up to date on the Game of Thrones TV series that's on HBO right now, read A Clash of Kings. It's awesome. Do it.
Of course, it's always great for Weekend Confirmed if you are interested to help out our sponsors.
Yeah, please do.
So, by the way, quickie. What do you think of the season 2 kickoff for Game of Thrones?
Oh, it's great. You can see we did an episode of Totally Rad Show on it last week. And
that's why I was pitching to you.
Yeah, no. I'm a massive, massive fan of that book series, and I'm so happy that they stay so faithful to it.
As has been brought up in some of the circles that I talk to around here in LA, so people know that I'm not claiming that this is my own independent thought, but I do agree in it, and it makes a lot of sense. That episode was an amazing piece of narrative artistry to hit every single faction and do it in a coherent way that established where we ended at 1, where we're starting in 2, and started moving the story forward in as short a period as it did. It's like, and you didn't feel like you'd bounced around, and you didn't feel like you got shortchanged, and you didn't feel like there was anyone left out, and you're like, holy shit, that was an amazing ride.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's great.
And then, you know, it was just kind of that juxtaposed with the 2-hour insanity of Mad Men.
Oh, I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, you should watch the 2-hour insanity of Mad Men.
I heard it's good.
It's good. It's intense. And it's kind of, it's like very gloves off.
Do you watch Justified?
No, I don't.
God damn, you guys got to watch Justified. It's so good.
You know what I can do? I can evidently watch that now on my PS3 through Amazon streaming. Because I don't know. Is it not on Netflix? Because Amazon was advertising it as one of their big deals to like watch.
I don't know if it's on Netflix.
But if you haven't checked that out, by the way, the Amazon app on PS3 is really fucking cool.
Is it?
Yeah, I'm kind of happy with it.
That just came out of nowhere, for me at least, that news. Yeah. Hey, by the way,
Yeah.
Well, you know what? They needed a get. They needed a good get in the entertainment space, and the timing couldn't have been better because Microsoft had just announced, you know, oh, look how many hours people are spending on Live, and look at all the entertainment they're consuming, and the Zune marketplace is the number two for-pay video marketplace in the world. Mm. And then Sony's like, oh, yeah, we're gonna add Amazon Video to PS3. Timed exclusive, thanks. Mm. I was like, whoa. Which is great because unlike Netflix and Hulu and even Vudu to a degree, I really didn't have a good way to get Amazon to my television. You know, I'm like, my friend Corey has a newer television that has like an app built. Oh, you know what? Actually, he does it through TiVo because I think TiVo had a built-in program for it. But there hasn't been a lot other than that. It's been like stream on your computer and like, whatever. But like fired up on the PS3, get right to it. It works pretty well. And their rental prices are decent. And do you guys ever rent HD video online? We got totally afield, but I'm just curious.
No.
I do for Mad Men because I don't subscribe to cable.
Yeah.
That's the only TV show I watch, so I'll, for $2, I'll rent it.
Jeff?
No, I do Netflix, or I'm always trying to keep up with my TiVo, my DVR, trying to battle that beast that keeps it at 90% somehow. Yeah, it's always at 90%.
You're never going to win.
I can't really say why my gears in my head turn this way, but I haven't really done that much online. You know, and part of it, I think, is that with Microsoft, I dislike having to buy Microsoft points. I think the whole thing, like, I'm going to trade dollars for a stack of numbers, and then that stack of numbers is never going to line up accurately with the amount of stuff I want to buy. So there's always like that weird slush fund. Like, that's irritating, and just having to go through the process is irritating. But I have an Amazon account, and I have, you know, by necessity, have a credit card linked to it. So I could see myself actually using this quite
and
a bit.
If you have Prime, don't you get like tons of free stuff?
There's like 17,000 downloadable videos on there. It's a good selection. It's not, I mean, there's a few things that aren't on Netflix, but Netflix still has a larger streaming library. But
isn't there a special, I mean, we should talk about video games.
Isn't there a what?
Isn't there a thing with Prime, if you have Prime, that you get free?
Yeah, there's like 17. Yeah, it's similar to Netflix streaming. There's like 17,000
plus. So it's like, not only are you subscribing to this cool video service, but you get 2-day shipping on Amazon. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's pretty great pack-in.
Yeah, and it's funny how people like approach that, because I actually do a lot of, because I'm busy all the time, I buy a lot of junk off Amazon anyway, so I've had Prime. So for me, I do treat it the way they sell it, which is just like the video is just a nice to have. Mm. It's like I'm not there for that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. Anyway.
Video games.
So, dude, what? It's so funny. The other night, Ryan and I are having dinner, and he's like, so, what kind of game do you think I'm making? I'm like, you bastard, why don't you just tell me? He's like, no, this is more fun.
It is more fun.
And
more fun for me.
And we were trying to guess. And by the way, it did say iOS.
Yeah.
More than once.
Yeah, that did come up.
And you being Kurt and Coy, you being coy, not Kurt, you being coy was like, really, you were trying to throw us off. You were totally trying to throw us off.
No.
Yeah, you were. You were trying to throw us off just to see what kind of response it would be. But anyway, Camouflage's first game, Republic stars Hope, who is trapped in a, I'll let you tell the story.
Well, yeah, the game is all about your relationship with an AI character. And the idea of the game was just started when I was hanging out with a good friend of mine, Alex Telvich, who owns this studio pretty nearby here in Venice, California, called Logan. And Logan is a production company that's responsible for the opening movie of Metal Gear Solid 4. And that's how he and I got to know each other, because that was one of the things I had. I was kind of as a producer on Metal Gear Owning. And so I was coming back and forth between L.A. and working on that for almost a year. It was a very long project. But anyway, so Alex and I kind of sat down. I told him my idea that I wanted to work on a game that, because I really, up until that point, I really looked down on mobile titles and iOS titles. And I thought, you know, this would be a really interesting challenge to create a game that I would really like to play, and something that was story driven. I'm not really into social games. I'm not really into like these kind of bite sized tiny tower. Although I do like Hero Academy, but that's very much an exception to the rule. So I really want to write a story and design a game that's specifically for a device that's in your pocket. And so that was really the idea of the game. And so initially we just started having these ideas that, what if when you start the game for the first time, you get a phone call from somebody you don't know, and then you answer it, and there's this beautiful looking girl on the other side who's in trouble and says, hey, my name is Hope. I'm 22 years old. I've been stuck in this facility my entire life. Please help me.
Okay, you already got me intrigued the moment my brain.
You said 22?
No.
Old?
that's a little old for me.
Jeez.
Wow.
The moment my mind clicked together, I'm holding a phone that I'm going to play a game on, and it's going to call. Whoa, that's really cool.
Well, thank you.
And it's sort of harkens back to a game that I think was way ahead of its time, Majestic.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, Majestic, that comes up when I tell people about the game. Other ones are Lifeline.
Well, Lifeline, bro, so you should tell the rest of the story, because we were just talking about Lifeline, because we have a huge joke running. Well, I have a huge joke that I remember back from EGM days of Crispin telling her to do horrible things and the weird responses.
Okay, so how about I
tell the rest of the story
a little bit,
yes,
and then we'll talk about this really horrific story about Lifeline.
We don't really need to do that story, but talk about your game.
All right, well, so that's so honestly, what I end up doing late last year was initially pitching this idea to some companies, some publishers, about this idea of kind of like a Mass Effect game with a really good looking 3D character on the other side, where you have like these dialogue trees and it's maybe more like Heavy Rain, and people were really interested in it, but they were really worried about like what the core gameplay loop is, right? They were basically saying you're approaching this game from very much like an interactive narrative perspective, and we like games like Heavy Rain, but yeah, this is maybe too high risk. And this kind of leads into some of the Kickstarter conversation we can talk about later in terms of the amount of risk that publishers are willing to take. So I kind of went back to the drawing board and we started just designing like, well, if we're going to add some action elements to it, what should we do? And through concept art, we realized early on that because your connection with this girl who's locked in this facility and she has a phone that she found, because in this kind of totalitarian nation, phones are outlawed. You cannot contact the outside. But one of the facility workers there had a phone. She got a hold of this contraband phone, calls the only number on it, which happens to be your phone. So we're trying to integrate the player into the story as much as possible. And so through concept art, we're realizing that, look, if players are hacking into this facility and viewing the world from surveillance cameras, then we're doing these top-down views that look very much like Resident Evil. And it was very serendipitous when we started thinking about, well, we can do pre-render backgrounds and focus all of the CPU power of the iPad and the iPhone onto the character, and then have some. It's kind of going old school, like in 32-bit era, where you know what games like Resident Evil and Parasite Eve had to do to really get some kind of cinematic gaming experience.
I think probably very did that too. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Probably very similar performance trade-offs that they looked at a decade ago,
absolutely,
to accomplish that same thing.
And it really shows. I mean, by the time you were listening to this,
you could talk about what you saw. The trailer's
out
next week.
The trailer's out on Monday.
Okay, so you can't see the trailer yet. We watched the trailer. And it really shows. It doesn't look like an iOS game. It's very high quality visuals.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, the team has been working really, really hard, and I really pushed them to have the same poly count and the same verts and the same bone count as around what an MGS4 character would have.
Wow.
And there were people like, this is insane. You know, this is just an iPhone. And I'm like, no, it's an iPhone. You know,
you're right. No, I know it's an iPhone.
Yeah. It's a very different way of thinking, right?
Do you guys worry about which iPhone version people are going to download? Is it like, well, you can only get it on a 4 or a
so we're going to have to 3G. Do something like what Infinity Blade 2 has to do, yeah, where it's like from this version above.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying, like, the load end, we're in that weird line between a 3GS and a 4. And so I don't think we're going to promise it for 3GS yet, but we're really going to try to get it to work for the 3GS.
And when you kind of found the need to add in that sort of repeatable, what was the phrase you used?
The core gameplay loop.
Yeah, gameplay loop.
Love that.
I like that.
That just spills off your tongue so smoothly.
Yeah,
you can tell. I've had to talk about that quite a bit in various pitch meetings.
Does that frustrate you that you sort of have to, you know, funnel your vision through that expectation? Or, I mean, I'm sure you found a great compromise and you're clearly excited about the game you made, but I'm wondering if that is just conceptually as a frustrating thing of like, I can't really go too far afield.
Absolutely. No, I think you're absolutely right. I really want to go in left field, and in my career I hope I can really go into a really different direction and make a game that had really, really nobody's ever played before.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, yes, I was frustrated, but then honestly around that time, it was around October, I was playing a lot of Dark Souls and getting back into this whole idea of like, I like action games, because I was really turned off for a number of years about what was happening in the AAA space when it came to action.
Hmm.
We kind of talked about like the whole roller coaster aspect of
things.
And it really brought back that game sense to it. And so the first thing we started doing then was prototyping, having Hope move from cover to cover. You know, she has limited amount of ammo, like with the taser that she's carrying, that she's kind of collected off of other guards. And that whole math you have to do of like, you have a room of 5 patrolling guards. You move from cover to cover, but you only have 3 taser shots. Hmm. Which of the 5 guards do I need to take down to help her get to the next room? And really trying to make it more sandboxy. So one of the most terrifying things, I think, for me this morning has been to see the news online and then go and see what people are saying. And, and I saw some comments about people saying that this looks like a really boring point-and-click adventure and that it's very scripted. And that's actually maybe it's my fault in terms of trying to communicate the game, but it's the exact opposite of what we want to do. We want to have it very sandboxy and really, like, you know,
you
a good action game that really gets your blood, you know, or like your the tension up and get your adrenaline running.
So there's a sort of narrator approach for how the player is contacting the in-game character of Hope. So there is sort of a layer of removal as you're guiding her and what's going on. She's trying to escape this facility. You did ultimately come to a core gameplay loop, right?
We did. We found it. And moving forward, the
what's
team,
that look like?
What the core gameplay game or the, what the core loop looks like?
Yes.
So I can give you an example of like a room that we were working.
That'd be great.
A few months ago now. And that was just, we had a room with different pillars and some cover points, and we put two guards that are patrolling around, and we were trying to figure out a way, that we're, to try to address some of my complaints about stealth action games like Metal Gear, that once you go through it one time, you know exactly what to do, the replayability.
It's solvable.
And you just learn the pattern, right?
Yeah.
And so one thing we've been trying to do is try to mix up the patrol routes. So actually in the proof of concept that you see in the trailer next week, there is actually a randomizing element of the patrol routes to try to make it so when players go back to rooms, again, like the mansion in Resident Evil, I want players to become more familiar with the space as opposed to going from it in a linear path. Mm-hmm. And to go back to that example of that room that we were working on, again, to try to make it more sandboxy and make it more dynamic, we introduced this idea of distraction objects. So players can not only tap on different touch on different cover points to send Hope to those areas, but they can also touch and hack into anything with a Wi-Fi connection. So it could be a computer, it could be lights on a panel, it could be like a retractable blinds on like on a window to give her cover or to turn off the lights to distract the guard to blind the guard.
Oh gosh!
Or I'm sorry,
I'm just I flashed. What was that GameCube game?
That GameCube game. There was a lot of GameCube games.
The one where you flashed your spirit into.
Oh, you're talking about Geist.
Yes.
Geist.
Yes.
Geist.
Yeah, so you're going to be able to hack into and become dog food. in the game, that's a feature.
Right.
So that's really talking
or
about the
Ghost same. Spirit just came out last year, right? For the.
Oh,
the
Ghost
DS.
Trick.
Oh,
Ghost, so Trick, Ghost Trick was a huge inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great game.
Eco was an inspiration for Hope because you don't control Yorda. She has a mind of her own, and you still feel a connection to her, and almost maybe more of a connection because she isn't a marionette.
Yeah.
And we're pulling lots of different inspiration from lots of
that's
different
awesome.
Things.
It looks great.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I would say that it does. I agree. It doesn't look like an iOS game.
No.
But the prospect of playing it that way, now that I know the the initial hook and I'm playing through this sort of tactile real world, duplicating what I'm doing in the virtual world,
acknowledging that you're playing on a device and working that into the narrative is pretty exciting to me.
Now, because I'm not associated and employed at a big publisher anymore or a big company, I one of the things I really enjoy about being independent is that I can tweet about something or I can talk about something without having to think like, where am I going to get fired for this? You know, and one of the things I really want to bring up that maybe I wouldn't be able to bring up if I was being represented by a publisher right now or if I was working at a big company is some of my deep down fears right now about what's going on with the reaction of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that we started off like I said, I wanted to make a game that I thought I would that I would like to play that was more story driven, that respected the platform and not did virtual joysticks, but really utilized what the device does, which is it's a touch based device.
Mm-hmm.
And then I like you said, don't read the comments, and I've been reading the comments, and there's a lot of people who are excited about, hey, this is the kind of game that I want for the phone. This is for the iOS. I see the future. I understand. Maybe they believe like me that there is space for serious games like this that might not be 99 cents or freemium.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also other comments about people like iOS, what the hell? And this is, you know, count me out. And there's a lot of hatred for that platform as well. And I think it kind of surprised me. And now it's making me a little bit worried about our Kickstarter campaign that's starting next week, because we're looking to raise, you know, a pretty good chunk of money. And it's not for PC, tablets, Mac, PC, or Linux. It's iOS, right?
Yeah.
And can we raise, you know, a good chunk of money and kind of follow in the suit of like what Wasteland did or Double Fine, and now with Shadowrun? Can
I
we
guarantee
do that
you,
with just one platform?
I guarantee you there are a bunch of people writing somewhere about Double Fine going, a freaking adventure game? Screw that. I don't want, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of that. So I wish you all the best, and I suspect you'll find a strong support so, base.
So. Taking a different approach, you know, a lot of time iOS games are produced on much shorter time horizons. Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound like this is one of those. What's your projected once you spin up and really get going on it?
Well, we're already spun up. Okay. I sold all of my, like, everything I basically owned except for the house, and I liquidated all my stock from Microsoft and spent my entire life savings to get us to this point. And so now we have a proof of concept in the trailer, and that's about it. Wow. And I've hired, you know, five guys have been sacrificing. Some people are not even getting paid. And we've been working with Logan that's doing this all of the pocket, not knowing where this thing is going to go. But we all believe, and I still believe, that there is a space out there for this, that this fear that I have right now is going to go away. And once somebody proves, other than Infinity Blade, which I'm glad it's out there, that's one of the games that really inspired me. It's like, wow, maybe the market is ready for this. I'm still nervous about next week, but I'm still going to do it. I'm still going to go. I'm not going to lower expectations. I'm not going to lower the goal that we were thinking. I'm going to put it out there and see if people respond. And if they don't, we now know. Maybe the game isn't good, and maybe that's why it wasn't successful. But it's going to be a good indication of
how long a production runway do you think to make the thing?
Oh, sorry, I didn't answer your question. Yeah, so we're looking for a year. We've planned out a year of production, so it'll be around. I'd like to get it out around spring of next year, but we have one little added hook to the game that makes it, I think, pretty unique that I'm looking to announce in the next couple weeks, and that might delay or extend the release date out maybe by another month or two.
You know, my theory is that the secret sauce of Kickstarter, and maybe it's not so secret, maybe it's obvious to everybody, but is the incentives.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's super, super important to, like, you know.
So can you partner with Samsung and get everybody like a Galaxy S5 when it comes out now?
I wish. I think there's two secret sauces, if you will. One is that I think what Double Fine proved is that a lot of the success in Kickstarter is that you're pre-purchasing the game. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's that before it was like, please donate to my game and I'll give you a wallpaper or something.
Yeah.
But that was now I'm thinking, yeah, I'm going to buy this game when it comes out anyway. I'll support them. I actually think there's a huge business that's going to happen in the next few years where, for example, what if, and I know I'm getting off track a little bit, but if Sega, for example, opened up Shenmue3.com and said, if you pledge $40 for Shenmue 3 or $50 for Shenmue 3 and we got to the 10 million mark or the 20 million mark, we'll make the game. I'm pretty sure.
I agree.
They could fund it that way. Yeah, for sure.
You know, and that's really exciting.
That's an interesting question. On Shaq, actually, in the thread last week, Agent R brought up Kickstarter because it's been really, you know, it's been a big subject for us. America, we have a story here about Shadowrun, which we're going to talk about in a couple minutes, which will blend into this. Wasteland, now over $2 million raised for that game. And Agent R asked, should publishers actually adapt and adopt a Kickstarter model for games where sales prospects are unknown, although interest level on the internet seems very, very high? And it ties right into something you talked about with Sega as well, where I have to find who was that? My SSSSS actually brought this up in regard to it seeming like Sega is dying and all of these properties that are sitting out there that never got sequels that would be, you know, love to have a sequel, like, you know, Shining Force, Skies of Arcadia is still sitting out there. You brought up Shenmue.
Lots of great IP.
Lots of great IP. So what about a publisher going this direction? And I guess the other thought while you're thinking about that, answering that, is the one piece that does come to mind for me is the one potential challenge for a pre-order mentality in this is that means that you're already spending the money that would come from the sales of the game. Mm-hmm. So if you fall off your timeline and you get into an extended situation, like, there's nothing to borrow money against because you've already sold the game. You've already sold it. You know, there's only a finite amount of revenue coming from that. Now, granted, you could still sell more copies, but you're back to a really sensitive situation.
And I think that's why if you have audience members out there that are sick of hearing about Kickstarter, then they should just get off the internet because there's going to be so many stories for years to come. Because what if one of these games that are getting funded right now comes out and it's not good?
What about when that happens?
To bring that up. So,
it's going to happen.
So, yes.
Like, what if my game comes out and it's not good? Like,
yes.
What kind, is there going to be a class action lawsuit? Like, that will happen. I guarantee that will happen.
Yeah. Or if not just that it comes out and it's not good. What if it doesn't come out?
What if it never comes out and the team's gone and who's going to make it?
Exactly. And who's responsible? Yeah. And that is going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen
tonight
in the video game
space. 60 Minutes.
Well, I don't know if it's going to happen in the video game space or in some other space, but there is going to be a Kickstarter scandal, for lack of a better word, that is going to really test that the viability of that business model. Because, I mean,
Melissa Stevens from Grand Rapids, Idaho, invested $150 in this game, It's now gone.
Which never arrived.
Never arrived or didn't come out as advertised or was a outright fraud that some unscrupulous individuals perpetrated on a
We went to this office park in Des Moines.
Well, I think you mock it, but true, dude.
No, I'm mocking it only because it will happen.
But don't Kickstarter's terms and conditions sort of mitigate a lot of that problem?
And they do, right? Yeah. I think in the legal text, I haven't read the fine print, but I think it's something to the extent of you recognize that this thing might not ever come out and you're not going to sue us.
Right, but then that may have an even worse.
It's as good as the paper it's written on.
It might be even.
And it's not even written on paper.
An even worse result, which is undermining the trust system that people have mm-hmm. in Kickstarter. I mean, Kickstarter has completely revolutionized the board gaming industry. Mm-hmm. It has changed it 100%. And it's just starting, as you say, in the video game industry. And I think.
Have board games that were kickstarted come to fruition already?
Oh, many of them.
Okay, that's good.
Many of the big games
I didn't realize
the biggest games of the year last year and the year before were Kickstarter games.
That's awesome because one of my concerns has been that I wondered how many products and projects had actually gone the distance and come to fruition because it seems like there's this groundswell and that's because I'm a video gamer and so that's I'm just now getting aware of it and video game projects take a while.
Yeah.
So there's not one I can just say already, oh, well, that's what happened there.
And that's an interesting point, too, is that, as you guys know, you've seen games in various levels of production, like what from the very beginning to near the end, is that when you come out and start thinking about what game you want to make, you have some bullet points and some features, and things change. It's a creative process, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, absolutely.
And, mm-hmm. a lot of these games, and one of the things that we were trying to do, and we're almost literally betting the farm on, is that with our Kickstarter campaign, we want to come out and show that the game is already moving, right? It's not just an idea, but we actually have something that people have played. And a lot of articles are going to be coming out next week of people actually were able to play the game and give impressions. And we felt that was really important. But for what about these games are just ideas and bullet points?
Yeah.
It's going to be games transform. Like, what if it's not as advertised?
And using Kickstarter as a way to sidestep publishers, there's a lot of checks and balances that sort of happen, mm-hmm. game testing that happens that structure has built up over time to sort of make a product in a specific way. And when you sidestep that and create a completely new way to come out with a product, I'm not saying it's necessarily bad, but it certainly has the potential to be bad.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and on that note, also what publishers bring is a good amount of pressure, right? Like this financial, like, hey, you're not getting your next check until you hit these deadlines, right? And I think for a lot of teams, that's really important. They need that to get to the finish line. But with that said, and I think maybe it was Tim Schafer who said this, is that they're even more motivated now than as opposed to having a publisher because it's the community. These people have helped you, like, bootstrap you and get you to be able to make this game. How much more do you feel like you need to get there and give them a great game? I'm hoping that we're going to be in that position.
I mean, if back in the day somebody had said, hey, we want to make this game called Daikatana. Contribute to our Kickstarter.
You made Doom? Totally.
Exactly.
Oh, no.
The hype surrounding the announcement of that project or Duke Nukem. We want to make Duke Nukem. You know,
well, that actually might
donate $1,000 and you will get your own metallic frog.
Yeah. Right. I'm just saying that the industry is rife with examples of best laid plans, well funded, turns into a complete fiasco, and that it's just bound to happen sooner or later.
Such is the risk of any sort of philanthropic, venture, right? You invest money or you're donating to something that's not done.
But I don't think people think about it that way. I don't think they think.
Not yet.
They think about I'm buying something that is definitely going to be this thing.
Yeah, that's something that people have to get over. I don't necessarily think there's something inherently wrong with that idea or that system of fundraising.
But I think it's going to test people's faith in it. And I think that is going to be a really interesting social experiment because once you have people going, well, I don't know if I can give my money to this kind of thing, it undermines the whole system.
So this is one side that I've been doing a lot of number crunching, looking at the Kickstarter successes. And there's a lot of people that are just pledging, basically pre-ordering the game, right?
Yeah.
But there's a huge amount, almost 50%, 40% of the revenue that people are bringing in are in that kind of mid-tier, like around $100 level, where they're kind of purchasing, like in quotation marks, purchasing things that maybe aren't worth $100. So there's a little bit of that donation aspect of it too, which is really cool. And that's really forced us to think of really creative ways of like, what are we going to offer at the $100 level, at the $50 level?
Well, there's a lot of passion though that's in play because especially a lot of these game projects are classic projects. So this like
or
Shadow,
feeling
so
they can
Shadow
make something
Run's
happen,
back.
Feeling that they can make something happen that wouldn't happen otherwise.
Yes,
having an investment that that way.
So, I mean, look at the Shadowrun project. And I thought of that because one of the things that they offer is that if you donate some, and I forget what, it's a really big number, but they'll have like the creator of Shadowrun come to your city and host the tabletop game of Shadowrun for you and your friends. Like, okay, that's pretty
crazy. I think they pretty much sold out of that tier, which is awesome. But like in terms of the percentage of revenue, like it's actually very small. That high tier, it's like they're kind of interesting talking points.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, like
so the middle tier is what you're thinking.
Yeah, the middle tier is really interesting. So one thing that we're looking to do, and I won't bore you guys with it, but I think what's really cool is that for a lot of these Kickstarter campaigns, for $100, you can get like a collector's edition. It's a physical item.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of these games that first started off as physical games with really cool hint books and maps and things, they're bringing it back, and people are willing to pay upwards of hundreds of dollars to get those kind of collector's items. But for an iOS game, like we can't package this into a box potentially, or maybe we can. There are some options for that we're looking into.
You can always get Hope's iPhone case.
Well, we're looking into that, honestly. I don't know if you're joking, but not.
No,
we are looking
into
that. And then we're also working on a book that is going to kill me if you think I look tired now. But there's going to be a companion book that's a little bit inspired by the Ni No Kuni book that they did for Nintendo DS.
Very cool.
But that you don't need to finish the game, but you can have in your pocket, and it's got lots of like maps and has like the bad guy, the antagonist, his name is the Overseer. It has his manifesto written in it, and like basically a book that's been passed around in the revolutionaries inside this kind of totalitarian world that you can kind of get a. And I
awesome.
And
that
I hope is, I hope people want it.
That's
I hope people
an awesome
like
piece
it.
Of swag, yeah.
But in and I hope as many people buy it as
that's extremely cool. So Republic,
I like it. So
there's more information around the internet today. The Kickstarter will kick off on Monday, along with your ability to check out the video. Camouflage is going to be really successful.
Well, thank you for saying that. I hope so. I'm nervous. I'm just excited to see what happens on Monday.
Well, we have to let you go back to work now.
I have to go finish the trailer.
Unfortunately, he's got to go finish the trailer that we saw that still had pieces that were like placeholder.
Yeah,
this belongs here.
Insert text and cool thing here.
Yeah, so go go do your cool things.
Thing. Yeah,
we still have half a show to do here. So if you stick around when we come back on the other side, we still have some Borderlands 2 to talk about. We
Kid
still
Icarus.
Have Kid Icarus to talk about. I'm playing Yakuza 4, but sort of.
And Ridge Racer.
And I played some Ridge Racer Unbounded. I'll talk about that for a minute because
Jeff's got a
Bugbear did a fantastic job with that.
Indie game, didn't he?
I do. An indie game that I just started.
Yeah. So there you go. Stick around. Weekend Confirmed. We'll be right back. This weekend, Gamefly is having its first ever PC Spring Sale. You can save up to 75% on great titles such as Battlefield 3, Batman Arkham City, Modern Warfare 3, Mass Effect 3, and many more. Just go to the show notes for this episode of Weekend Confirmed and look for the links to the spring sale towards the bottom of the post. All right, everybody. Great to be back. I want to pick up just a little bit on that Shadowrun Kickstarter because that one's kind of got also a link back to the show because it was the video for it has the return of none other than Mitch Gittleman, who's a great guy. You'll probably remember if you're a longtime listener to the show back in the day when the Shadowrun first-person shooter Xbox 360 PC game came out. He was on that was early. That was probably One Up Yours time still. And we had a very interesting interview, which I think everybody now knows that like he and I had talked about it ahead of time. And they wanted to, you know, he was adamant about wanting to upfront address the concerns that Shadowrun fans had about the franchise. And so we had a rather, it was an animated interview, let us say. Did you hear, Jeff, you look
oh,
at
yeah,
you remember
of course.
That? So anyway, unfortunately, though, the result of the game was still not up to the expectations of Shadowrun fans. And, well, let's just say there's a little Easter egg, not even Easter egg, there's a little moment in there for you guys who wanted to always get back at Mitch in that. So, you know, go to Kickstarter, watch that. They're doing great already. They've raised their money, Shadowrun Kickstarter. The creator of the franchise, Jordan Weissman, is back, and they're going old school. They are making this thing for tablets and PCs. Now, one of the things they did point out is if you're donating to the Kickstarter, you're going to get the PC version because they don't have the same avenue to give it away on mobile devices. So, you know, if you're Kickstarter, you're going to get a PC version of the game. But it's going to be old school, 2D RPG, and they were very clear about identifying that, you know, the three pillars for them of an RPG is great story with fascinating characters whose motivations actually make sense, a fun world to explore, and character development options that, as you get better with your character, open up new things to do as well inside the game. So if you're a Shadowrun fan, that's probably pretty exciting for you because it's old school.
I'm also really excited to hear about Borderlands 2 because, as we talked about, like, I didn't play that for a long time, and then Ariel and I started playing it, and...
Oh, man, Borderlands was...
We had so much fun with that game.
Yeah, the first game's co-op is just sublime. It's really good.
And Jeff played it played 2 now for 4.5 hours.
I did.
And I said, you bastard.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
And 4.5 hours was not enough.
No, clearly.
It's everything you love about Borderlands 1... But more of it.
Okay.
Which sounds like a
cocktail napkin pitch.
It's exactly what they set out to do. And from my play session, it seems like they really did that. To the point where my only gripe coming away from it was, wow, it seems like there's so much of that. Specifically loot. I love loot, but my God, it was exploding out of everywhere. And I literally...
That's what she said.
You cannot... spend the time to pick up all the guns and look at them. I mean, there's so much.
And even in the first game, it some of it became a stat comparison, quick look, like,
oh yeah,
does this gun have a better number here than this gun?
Well, I think they did an even better job of this time around is the guns feeling very different from each other. It's not just a stat thing. Although it is a stat thing, but it's not just that. It's look and feel. They went way far afield of making guns look so much different than each other, move in different ways, have glowy bits, have non-glowy bits, have wildly different models so that you really feel like you're using a very different gun than you were just 2 seconds ago.
That's promising.
Very promising.
As an aficionado of loot gathering games,
yes,
which I one of my all-time favorites, I've thought about this a lot, especially because... You know, you look at some of the less successful games, and they always seem to have copious amounts of loot. You're like, why did this not work? But then,
That was one of my big gripes of Amalur was like, for the first 6 awesome things I picked up, armors I picked up, they all looked exactly the same.
Yeah, loot in that game's kind of fucked.
Yeah,
you end up picking up a whole bunch of shit that you can't even use or that is like way lower than your level.
And you get like this awesome purple robe, and it looks exactly like my lame robe I was wearing 4 seconds ago.
Correct. So appearance, I think, is super important.
Huge.
And then the other one is you got into like you're just doing a quick stat comparison, and I think that a lot of them fall into that trap of it's X amount better attack, X amount better defense,
right,
or something better magic boost. What's really cool and what I've realized as I thought about like the why I changed from weapon to weapon or armor to armor is it's more about like what's unique about this thing.
Yeah.
What does it give me that's either a spell modifier or a stat upkeep or something that's really interesting, and you know, even if sometimes elemental attack.
Yeah.
And then so not only does it look unique when I have it, but it does something that's special and allows me to really tailor what I'm doing and not just, oh, you are 20 points higher on your attack value.
Yeah, and they're really good about throwing enemies at you that are impervious to certain attacks, so you have to switch up your weapons.
So they had that before, right?
Right. That's what I'm saying. The series is really good at that, but I really want to highlight how much the feel is not just the look, but the feel of the guns from gun to gun. They felt so much different from each other, and I didn't feel that in the first Borderlands. There was some of that, but in this time, I would literally pick up a gun and just shoot it a couple times to see if I liked how it felt. They do things with
definitely different.
Yeah, recoil changes, speed of the shot, the kind of shot, the sound of the shot. It just feels different. I picked up a shotgun with a scope on it. I mean, that's awesome. It's awesome. It was a shotgun
I'm rolling my eyes a little bit.
It was a sniper shotgun. It was badass. I picked up a gun that was
completely ridiculous.
Yeah. Completely ridiculous. I mean, ridiculous is sort of the
doesn't
name
it
of the
sort
game,
of break
though.
the hierarchy of the arsenal to have a scoped shotgun?
Well,
you can have a scope on a. I've seen scopes on shotguns in fantasy games, of course, but they still have some range limitation. I don't want to be able to headshot a guy at, you know, 50 yards with a shotgun.
Well, then it's not really a shotgun, is it? I mean, I guess technically,
even if it has a slug in it.
But. Yeah, a few of your pellets will hit him in the head.
Yeah. Ow, what's that?
But this game definitely...
That's also what she said.
...is definitely over the top in every sense. I mean, the two classes that they had on display, the one that I played the most was the new Gunzerker class.
All right.
And that is a guy whose special superpower is that he can dual wield any two weapons in the game.
So even sniper, two heavy machine guns...
Two heavy machine... Sniper rifle rocket launcher, pistol...
Would you like to blow shit up, Gunzerker, or whatever?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice little Clerks reference. So It's you're way over the top already because I can dual wield two rocket launchers if I want to. I can dual wield two sniper rifles if I want to.
I can't aim both of them.
I mean, that's his whole thing. That's his
how
whole
would
thing.
I aim with a wait? But how do I pull both? How do I have two triggers? And how do I even do that in a video game?
Shooting from the hip.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying is I couldn't aim them. I wouldn't be able to take advantage of them being a sniper.
Well, no, I mean, it's pretty badass because his whole skill tree is all about building up awesomeness that happens when you dual wield stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one of his main skill trees, which I put a lot of points in. Like, it was really cool. They gave us leveled up characters.
I mean, it's cool because of the whole elemental thing. Like, you could have, like, an acid shotgun,
yeah,
right, which would be awesome, and then, like, an explosive submachine gun. So
right.
You can, like, you know, bang them with that real quickly to take their armor down and then come back with the fire and ignite them.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of cool elemental combos that could enter in there.
Yeah. It was really fun. I mean, they gave us some leveled up characters and I was able to test out a lot of the different talent trees. The talents themselves, at least in the Gunzerker class, it didn't feel as overpowered as I often felt in the first Borderlands with the eagle that could...
Oh, right.
Do just go and get you money from people and just, you know, it was crazy.
What character class was that?
Sniper.
The sniper dude. Yeah. What was his name? I can't remember his name, but
Mordecai.
Yeah. Mordecai. Yeah. Yeah.
I played
Mordecai,
the soldier who
you,
was like
Mordecai. Yeah. You yeah. run into him in, or at least I ran into him in the demo we played.
Oh, nice.
He's not playable anymore, but the world is still going and you run into him as a NPC.
What is the hook for the world, by the way?
It's, I can't remember, X number of years later. It's a few years later. And you are, I didn't really get much story bit to the demo we showed.
Are you still looking
action.
For, like, the vault thing was resolved?
Yeah. More bad guys. The environments
more
are,
bad guys.
More yeah. bad guys coming at you. The environments are much more varied and lush looking. It's a prettier game in a lot of ways. More color to it. A lot of, you know, going into, there's an island hopping sequence that I did in the demo. But I didn't get a sense of exactly what the story was. There wasn't much of that available in what we saw. But, man, is it fun right from the get-go. And the thing that they're doing also with the
loot... So did you play Gunzerker?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and the other one was the chick, the Siren, I believe it is.
From the earlier game.
No, it's a new... Maybe it was not called Siren, but...
She's a Banshee. Or no, I'm just kidding. I don't know.
Yeah. It was the female... That they've changed Siren class or a new different Siren class. I should have my notes with me, but I don't.
Harpy.
Anyway, one of the things that they're doing with the loot.
Harpy, that's a good one. Yeah. I would play a harpy.
You know how there's like billions of guns? Well, now there's billions of everything. So there's billions of grenade types. There's billions of mods. Remember how you could put a mod on your body and do.
Yes.
So there's as varied as the guns were in the first game, everything is. So there's so much loot coming at you all the time that it's almost overwhelming.
I was going to say, is it possible to oversaturate that sort of thing?
That is my feeling.
So you just get to a point where you're like, I don't care. Just, I want to shoot something. I don't want to manage my.
Yeah. It almost becomes tedious to like, Jesus, there's so much shit on the ground right now because I just cleared this area out
right.
that for me to find what might be a better gun amidst this just piles of shit,
yeah,
it's almost like I'm just going to stick with what I got. I'm just going to keep moving forward and shooting stuff.
Well, now you can still like do a cursor hover over stuff when you get close enough without actually picking it up.
Right? Yes. Yeah. It still does that cool like in view sort of... like the scene from Fight Club and when he goes through IKEA and it's like bloop, bloop, bloop.
Oh right
you know what I mean?
Okay,
there's a name for that but I'm not like there's a little tag that shoots up and just shows you the quick stats so yeah there's an easy way to do it but
it wasn't but it was the problem I think in the first game was that it was just the stickiness of stuff lack of stickiness or the ability like yes if you had the cursor on just the right spot and you held the X button down then it would pick up a group but only a group of a certain size circle
right
and then it was hard to get on just the thing you wanted to pick it up like that's
have they and I ended up picking up 12 other things
no,
they do a really cool thing now which I don't think was in the first game you can correct me if I'm wrong but where you can immediately pick something up and change it to money I believe.
So it's basically
I might
like
be talking out of my ass on that. Let me not say that because I might be confusing it with another game I played.
I want to tell you about something.
It was 2 weeks ago we played Borderlands 2, so I might
maybe
be thinking
not.
Of something else.
Wait, what could you convert shit into in the first Mass Effect game? Like some sort of gel that you used for hacking?
Oh yeah,
I'm glad
you used your Omni tool for that.
Yeah, but there was Omni gel.
So pretend I didn't say any of that last sentence.
Say anything what?
What else can I tell you about Borderlands? It's
vehicles.
No, they didn't have any vehicles in the demo we played. The enemy types are really cool. A lot of new ones, a lot of mechanized ones. We were playing. There's like this bulldozer dude that looks like he was built out of a bulldozer, and he bum rushes you. Interesting quest objectives. Instead of killing everybody in this area, at one point you have to just knock them down to a certain health and not kill them, so that they send an alert so a door will open. I thought that was interesting, and I'm really hoping the game has more varied quest objectives like that, where you have to do something a little bit out of the ordinary.
Right. The question about characters, none of the four original characters are returning.
Right.
It's all four. It's four new characters. The first one was Salvador, who you played as a Gunzerker. It's a new class. The other one is a Siren.
Right. Changed Siren, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Similar to Lilith, her name is Maya, but she has a different ability that's called Phase Lock. Mm-hmm. Phase Lock.
Which basically puts somebody into a force field and hovers them in the air for a little while. Kind of like Mass Effect. When it was super fun. Super fun when my co-op partner would do that and I would gunzerk the shit out of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was...
I'm looking forward to it, man.
I mean, there's nothing... Sounds good. There's really the only negative that I came out of that was, like, there's just so much shit. There's just so much loot. But it's going to deliver, I think. If you like the first Borderlands, it is not reinventing the wheel. It is giving you just more of what you love with... I think upgraded visuals, a more interesting palette, a more interesting world to be running around in, and lots more cool weapons to shoot stuff with. So can't beat that. It looks really awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yay,
I'm cool with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we don't wind up missing it, I think that because we know Ryan Payton left and said he was going to listen, that we should let Jeff do his indie thing.
Oh, yeah. Go for
it. Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is I haven't finished this game.
I call it his indie thing. Right. I could just go ahead.
Indie Jeff. Dun, 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 dun.
So, dun, dun, dun. And I think Ozzy has a review that'll be coming out of this, too.
Ozzy Osbourne?
Ozzy, one of our other writers on Shaq.
You know, it's a really great game. It's really great. I don't really like it. Sharon.
That's far too coherent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's do Ozzy Osbourne and Keith Richards having a conversation. They should have their own radio show. So Lone Survivor is the game that I'm sort of hyping up today. I just started playing it. It is a survival horror game, but the catch is that it's 2D, sort of 16-bit era graphics style. So it's sort of crude, blocky graphics. But it's really, really heavily steeped in atmosphere. Now, there's action elements, too, like things will try to kill you. But resources are scarce, so you sort of have to really decide whether you're going to hide from something or shoot it or, bait it with rotting meat or, all this sort of really, really cool atmospheric stuff. There is a demo for it that you can play, an in-browser demo that you can play on Kongregate, I think.
Is it an in-browser game?
No.
Ah.
It's an actual executable, but that's sort of – he got some sort of promotional deal with them. It's Super Flat Games. Has also made some flash games in the past. But it's really neat because, we always talk about survival horror and how hard it is to do that correctly.
Yeah.
When you and then to find a game like this where visually you look at it and it's like, yeah, it's creepy. He does a lot of stuff with light and limited visibility, and the creatures that you run into are abstract and twitchy enough that they're creepy. You want to avoid them. They create that sort of sense of unnerving, being disturbed. But it does it really well in this really sort of, I don't want to call it crude presentation because it's very well thought out, but it's not hyper realistic graphics and stuff. So anyway, Lone Survivor.
What's the controls like?
It's just keyboard. The version that I'm playing is keyboard to move around, left and right arrow keys.
Yeah.
And then you've got a interact key and you've got a shoot key and then you've got a key that'll bring up your inventory. So you pick stuff up and use it in sort of puzzle fashion. And then you have a few hotkeys that you can do to, drop meat really quickly or, like something's chasing you or whatever. I'm pretty early into it. But, it was recommended and so far having a really good time with it.
I think we need to get better at doing our indie stuff.
You
talk about this all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. I was the one who was doing mine. Most of the time.
What is that supposed to be? Are you getting catty with me?
Well, I'm just
I'm just saying.
I'm not saying. I'm just saying.
I'm not just saying. I'm saying.
Well, I'm happy to bring more indie love whenever possible.
It. I'm excited about that. I love that. That's what's so awesome about Mattis.
Aw.
That's indie Jeff to you, Jeff.
I know.
Either way.
So let's see. What else? I picked up. So I've been playing two games. So one thing, actually, like someone asked me last week in the show notes about how I felt about Final Fantasy XIII's ending.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great to get to the ending, and I really liked getting there, and the cinematics at the end were astoundingly awesome and beautiful, but there's a lot of weird shit that happens at the end that is just really bordering on metaphysical babble.
Mm.
But it was still fun. It was still fun, and it was still rewarding because they did at least, you know, go through a lot of it, and it was really
Did you do that so that you could play 13 too?
You know, no.
Are you going to play 13 too?
That was actually the question I was thinking about the answer to that I didn't have, which is I think at this point probably not, because knowing what I know from watching Ariel play it and where it goes and how it's set up, I just don't think I'm in for that ride right now. I think there's stuff I'd way rather play. You know, Xenoblade, I'm chomping at the bit to get a hold of. And I started Yakuza 4, and it has its hooks in me as well as 1 did. I mean, it's just, it's so fun. It's like, so my game. And people out there are like, yeah, you say that, but then you don't play it. Well, you know, it's like, it is nice to actually have a chance to have a break here where I was actually able to slot it in and play it. And I'm going to stick with it because I'm already, I mean, it has definitely got its hooks in me to the extent that, you know, in like 3 or 4 sessions, all 3 or 4 sessions have been multi-hour, like sit down and really play it.
Hmm.
Now, part of that is because the save layout in the game is not really, really very friendly.
They kind of make you do that.
Yeah.
It's really not that well thought out as far as like saves and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, man, there's something about the narrative hook in the game that really works quite well. And I think that partially it's because it is, in Japan, a high-level narrative story game. You know, they hire a fantastic crew of actors to work on this game. It's a very high-profile game there, which, you know, a lot of the Western audience doesn't appreciate so much. So, yeah, the script is already there. But just the way it's put together, the pacing of it, the story it's telling, all those things are really, really, really solid. And there are pieces of the game mechanics that are rough, but it's put together in a way such that I'm willing to overlook that. For instance, there's a chase mechanic that they keep going back to, and it's just not very good.
Hmm.
And it's partially because the way you control your character is not nearly responsive enough to really make chasing fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like, and you're trying to fight the camera at the same time. And one of the core pieces to the mechanic is that there's a quick turn you can execute. And if you do it right, then you get like this little whoo, and you speed up for just a second. So the way you're supposed to catch up to people is chase them through hard turn maze like layouts and get those speed turns at the right spot. And then by getting the speed turns, gradually catch up to them. And it's more often than not a matter of hoping that when you hit the speed turn, if you get it right, that your guy, when he turns, slides into the right spot so that he goes forward. And I say guy because I'm into the second act, and I'm like in the fifth chapter of the second act, and I'm playing the second new character. So there's 4 characters now that you play, and you don't play Kazuma until the end, I guess. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't even know where you play him. I fought him, which I thought was really weird.
Hmm.
And the way they tie this thing together, it's really well put together. And then there's also like you get to be a head of a hostess bar. That's kind of fun.
Where they have little dress up mini games and stuff.
They do have a dress up mini game. I kind of like the dress up mini game.
I'm actually playing it too.
I'm admitting. Are you?
Oh, yeah. I'm on the second character right now, and I've been slowly. It's one I kind of go back to.
How did I not know this, Jeff Mattis?
Well, it never came up. Yeah,
it's awesome.
So, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And what you were saying is, I pretty much agree with everything that you said so far. I would say that you're right. The movement. It feels to me like earlier, like pre-GTA 4 GTA games, you know? So it's like you don't have that physical weight that the character has.
What do you think about the combat?
I think it's fun. I don't think it's incredibly, like, deep or challenging. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do.
Yeah.
But like, the mechanics of it are like, you know, press this button, bam, do a special move. You can buy more moves and sort of, you know, but even into like
I think it's too easy.
Partway into chapter two.
I think the
yeah.
problem is it's too easy. And I remember it being more interesting and more challenging in one. Now, part of the thing in one was there was a steadier flow in this narrative rhythm of mini bosses. Mm. And there's only been a couple so far. And the boss fights so far, okay, the second boss fight, which was the one underground with the dude with the chainsaw.
Yes.
That's where it actually started to get a little more interesting because you really had to start using combos and using some of your defense mechanisms that you'd learned. But prior to that, like most of the day-to-day combat that you get at this point, I've gotten to the point where I almost just rather breeze past it.
Mm-hmm.
So the combat's really...
Oh, especially the dudes that stop you on the street.
Like, yeah,
you're
really?
Just like, chop, like, chop, chop, you're done. Yeah.
Yeah, so the combat in the game, it drops into a 3D space of wherever you were, and then it's very brawler. So you have, one of the shoulder buttons locks you onto your opponent. You have, like, a quick attack, a heavy attack. You have a grab or object pickup. So you're, like, alternating between these things, and then, like, a dash escape step.
Mm.
And the different characters, at least the first two, have mm-hmm. very different sort of fighting styles. The first guy you play has a very kickboxing sort of orientation where he has a very fast kick and a very heavy kick, but most of his attacks are that way. The second guy you're picking is more of a heavy brawler sort of guy. He has a charge up attack for his heavy, mm-hmm. but you have to like think about setting it up and being mm-hmm. in a clear to set it up. And all of those things would be cool if the enemies were just a little more demanding. And I think there is a hard. And I'm not sure what the hard does, and I'm kind of reluctant to go there at this point.
I'm just wondering if some of that was due to the fact that they don't really... I mean, yeah, it's the fourth game in a series, and the combat's kind of built on itself. But it doesn't really do a good job of sort of, you know, illustrating all of the
This game doesn't
things,
teach you shit.
No, like, so you're just kind
it's
of
really
figuring
funny.
Stuff out as you go, you know?
It doesn't have anything for your tutorial at the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, if you haven't played... the funny thing is that if you haven't played Yakuza before, there's no reason to be intimidated by the story because they do an excellent job. Yeah. There's this movie theater thing you can go into and see movies of all of the prior games. And they were great for me because... along with playing one, I had played a good bit of two, but I actually thought I had bailed out of two early, and as it turned out, I almost finished two. Hmm. Makes me like want to go find my save because I'm like, well, shit, I was at the end of two. I could have finished that game. I didn't play three, which people have slacked me for, but whatever, that's fine. Like, you can pick up four because you can go and see all of these narrative threads, put it all together, and it's really good. Like, I couldn't recommend it enough, and the combat is really fun. I'm hopeful that as we move through into the third and fourth characters that it does get at least a little more challenging,
yeah.
and not just from like bosses that are cheap.
No,
like,
no,
I don't want that. I would actually just like really, I think the fighting engine is pretty fun, especially because part of the mechanic is that you build up the spirit gauge, and when it goes up to its limit, then you unlock, what do they call those?
I don't know, like, it's like a rage move or
rage
something.
Rage moves.
Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
And they're different contextual ones, and then you are able to unlock more by buying them off of the points you earn from experience in each fight. So there's like this really cool loop of fighting more and earning more experience and unlocking better moves and then using them in the fight, mm-hmm. except for the fact that you don't have to.
Right. Mm.
And then once you've gained a rage move, the more you use it, it starts to power up as well. And once it's powered up, then it adds in a quick time event inside the move to do even more damage, which is cool. And there's all kinds of, like, there's other little cool things that are built into the game at the same time. There's this sort of side mission-y thing of you taking pictures of people with your cell phone. Mm. And so like you find mm-hmm. out about this side mission deal where you take pictures of people who are engaged in conflicts where something's going to happen, and if you take all three pictures, which are also quick time events, then you'll learn a special move. And they're fucking absurd. They're so hilarious. The first one is like this dude who's like this crazy underwear bandit.
Yeah.
And he's like wearing women's underwear as his like Cape Crusader costume, and he's jumping around the rooftops of Kamurocho, and you like have to take pictures of him in three spaces. But after you've done that, the payoff is you get this really cool group attack move.
Hmm.
So, and it's kind of gives them this opportunity to like add this like little absurd, funny twist to it.
Yeah.
It's a really fun game.
Well, and the thing on top of all that, the thing that really keeps me wanting to play it overall is being a Westerner, getting exposed to a story in a Japanese video game that isn't like super fucking crazy. Like, it's
what
crazy.
What you just said, notwithstanding.
Well, right, but no, but I'm yeah. Well, but I mean, the actual narrative of the game is like rooted in reality. Like, you could have an underpants.
It's a soap opera,
sort of.
It's a soap opera.
It is, but it's like
it's a mobster soap opera.
Yes, but you're not gonna. Yeah, Right. You're not, nobody's summoning shit and like, right. you know.
Just putting on ladies' underpants and running across the rooftops.
Yeah, and doing dress up in the club.
But the interplay of the families and especially how far back they go into the history and yeah, some of the stuff that's happening now with, yeah, it's just really cool. I will willingly take the listener lumps for having waited so long to play it. And yes, I am thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying it and love it and couldn't if you recommend it more if you haven't played it already. So there you go. Yakuza 4. There'll be more. There'll be more as we finish it. So you should dig in so we can keep talking about
it. Yeah, I should. I'll pick it up and go back in.
Because I will be willing to bet you that I'll probably push myself to finish it over this weekend because I'm so freaking wired on it.
Okay.
I want to get to it.
Okay. Well, I'll dive back in for sure.
All right. And I'm probably not going to go back much to Ridge Racer Unbounded, but when we come back on the other side, I'll talk about it for a minute because Bugbear, who's the developer on this thing, did a great job, even though I don't know why it says Ridge Racer on the packing. I mean, it's really bizarre that it says Ridge Racer on there. We've got that. I want to talk a little bit about Capcom and them pissing people off with their response to the Better Business Bureau. There's still so much more to talk about, and we only have one segment left. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Surviving survival horror. Surviving, surviving,
surviving survival horror.
Surviving, surviving.
It's going to be interesting.
Surviving, surviving.
So you got that to look forward to.
Surviving, surviving.
Sergeant, what are you doing?
What?
Just give me the control. Give me the control.
Why do you have them like that? Where's this? Where's this?
Just give me the control. Give me the control.
And you do that, then you leave.
Surviving, surviving.
Oh, he's getting really upset with me now. I'm so sorry.
Surviving.
Liquors, yep. Nemesis, yep. Zombies, yep.
Dogs, fuck! Sergeant, what are you doing?
Nothing, sir. There's a dog coming at us.
Brad, put a dog in the goddamn game!
I think I've injured his pride.
You're that kid that comes over to people's houses and like they're playing Nintendo and you grab the controller and you're like, just let me beat it for you. I'll show you the end of Zelda. Let me beat it for you.
Oh, Spicer. I'm glad that while he was gone, we got to slag on him some.
Yeah.
It was good.
It's always fun.
All right. So because I asked on Twitter and people were interested in me picking it up some, I checked out Ridge Racer Unbounded for a while last night. I spent about probably 2.5-3 hours with it, which was definitely long enough to get an impression of a racing game. And I would tell you within 5 minutes, I was like, wow. I have to
Ridge.
Say, I went
Racer.
In. So first of all, I at least knew that Ridge Racer Unbounded was a completely different direction for Ridge Racer. And I knew it was being done in the West. I had not until I looked it up known it was Bugbear who did it. And that's the Flat Out guys. And that explains a lot, which is that this game technically is really good. Hmm. It's really, really, really good. It looks fantastic. The physics modeling of... It feels like to me, you know, I was having this moment of it's super derivative. It's burnout. Need for Speed. It's Need for Speed,
like
Burnout,
that.
And it says Ridge Racer on the packaging, and you're like, what the hell? Why does this say that? So it's very much focused on building up your turbo. And once you have your turbo, there's three sorts of races. One of them, though, the most common one is a destruction derby sort of thing, where when you build up your power and get your turbo, not only does it give you a turbo boost, but it gives you the ability to smash through the environment and smash other cars.
Huh.
So you're doing this
risk. Classic Ridge Racer.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with Ridge Racer. It's the weirdest thing. Hmm. I mean,
Unbounded, dude.
Other than it has fantasy cars. But
dude, I just got to try. Unbounded has got to be the worst fucking subtitle for anything.
It's such a weird name. It's such a weird game in general. It's like
all the previous Ridge Racer games, they were bounded.
Unbounded.
Yeah. Couldn't you just say Unbound?
Unbound.
No, Unbounded.
But couldn't you just say Unbound?
Limitless.
What's the difference?
Boundless?
Yeah. Boundless. Anyway, if you're looking for, if you have to scratch that itch right now, I would say that it's an absolute must wait for it to go on sale because it's inevitable for that to happen.
Aww.
Dude, I'm sorry. Like,
true,
this is that weird world of like weird mid, like it's so hard to say that that's a $60 game, right? Because it is so derivative, but it is really well put together. And you know, the other thing that was really surprising to me is that so often in these games, especially Need for Speed style games, you sit down. And the first levels, you just blow through them. You're like winning right off the bat. You don't win right off the bat in this game. Mm-hmm. Like you actually sit down and it's challenging and it's not, doesn't feel super cheap. It just feels like, oh, this is a really good racing game with a good mechanic. And I just need to sit here and figure out how to play it. And as you sit there and dive into it and really get better at it, you're like, I can see how I can shave my way off, you know, and get up to first place, but I'm actually gonna have to work at it some. And it feels the car feel is really spot on. It's really bang on. It feels really good through the sticks. And then there's just so many pieces that just I would love to have seen this game as a Need for Speed game with Need for Speed's you know, more refined presentation and better social interaction and better UI and stitching together, because like individual races in this game are good, but then most of the rest of the juice holding it together is just not, it's really immature and not there. Anyway.
That's kind of surprising though.
Why is that?
Well, no, not that particular item, but just that it's decent.
Oh,
you know, like that's,
dude, it's better than decent.
I'm still reeling
from
that.
Like, it's definitely better than decent. It has a level editor where you can make your own layouts and put them up on multiplayer in order to be challenged, but you can also invite people to come in and play them. So there's a simultaneous asynchronous play idea of having time matching, but also you can bring friends into those maps and also race them. So
that's,
it has
really cool.
Best
that's...
of both worlds there. Yeah. It's a totally surprising title that weirdly doesn't have a lot of marketing support behind it. More strangely, has the Ridge Racer name on it, so you have all sorts of weird, wrong expectations for it. And then you can sit down and play it, and you're like, wow, this is a really good, like, really good Need for Speed Burnout-style racing game.
Mm-hmm.
Bizarre. Totally bizarre.
Marketing fail, perhaps.
Speaking of bizarre,
yes.
Did you guys play Kid Icarus?
No, I didn't.
Uprising? Did
not.
You play it?
I have not.
For 3DS?
Ozzy, speaking of Ozzy, Ozzy played it for us.
He
reviewed it for us. He liked it a lot. Yeah. You know what? He liked it because, and I want to find out, I'll start here because I think everyone's biggest concern is the controls because they've heard about it. And yeah. He liked it because not long into it, he figured out that he could do away with the whole like craning his hand thing around and just play with buttons because it had customizable controls that he could set up the way he wanted them.
Yeah, that's true. I had a disadvantage being left-handed. Right off the bat, but you know, it does offer.
They've told
you
that all your life, haven't they?
They have, and I do have a chip on my shoulder, so bear that in mind during this review. But you know, they do have a control option for lefty, and they also advise you to go out and purchase the
circle pad,
which I did not do, but it should be included because fuck you guys for not just catering to a portion of the population. Fuck that.
But it comes with a stand.
It does come with a stand, and it took me the reason I played it so much, I mean, I was excited about it, but I also went on vacation last week, as you guys know, and so I took my 3DS with my new Kid Icarus, so I'm all excited. I'm going to be on the plane. Perfect.
Of course.
Right? Yeah. So I did not bring the stand with me and did not play on the stand until I got back and realized there's a fucking reason why they put the stand in the box. There's a reason.
It wasn't window dressing.
No. It certainly makes the game much more comfortable to play.
Oh, really?
Much more comfortable to play.
Okay.
This is not a game I could play.
Doesn't that sort of defeat the portability element?
Bingo.
Yes, sir. This is not a game that I could play for hours at a time. This is not a game I could play for halves of hours at a time.
Oh, really?
It's a game that I really enjoyed playing.
Did you, like, crisscross your hands or something? Like,
No. It lets you... change the functionality of the face buttons to be what the circle pad would do.
Buttons. It's like what PSP games used to do, where like the buttons could be movement.
It's what old Dreamcast. It's how I play Dreamcast Quake.
Oh shit!
Yeah, that's exactly how I
think about that.
So I mean, it's kind of a smart solution in a lot of ways because it works. And really, this is two different games in one box. It's very much two disparate games that bear some slight resemblance to each other.
Okay.
One of them is this freaking awesome Space Harrier-esque flying game that is so much fun and visually spectacular and really just an incredible experience, especially in 3D. And the other is this janky, effed up, frustrating, asinine running around third person action shooter game that every level is a mix between the two. So in every single level you start off flying and I was having great fun shooting and chaining attacks and flying around stuff, and you could, you know, it's just like Space Harrier, which is one of my favorite arcade games of all time. You can control your guy, but you're on a—
Can I interject for a second?
Yep.
I think Space Harrier reference might be lost a little bit. So a picture,
Panzer Dragoon, maybe?
Picture a 3D environment that you're flying into.
Right.
So then you're like flying into this as if you were a flying plane, but now you have a 3D character suspended in space that you're able to move around with the sticks and then fire into the space.
So. Yeah. So they're controlling how you fly through the environment. You're controlling where on your screen your character is as he flies through that environment. So you have.
Sorry, I just thought we should explain.
No, absolutely. So as projectiles and enemies are coming towards you, you do have to dodge out of the way, but you never are responsible for navigating through the level. You're on rails in that sense. And that is really, really fun. Fighting the enemies is really fun. As I said, visually, it's spectacular. I think it does a pre-rendered movie, basically, of the environment, flying through the environment. And it's so stunning, especially in 3D. It really uses 3D in a fun way.
And then you land.
And then you land. Every single level, you then arrive at your destination and land. And the game turns into this frustrating, mind-numbing exercise in trying to control the camera with the stylus. And so basically, in the flying sections, you use the stylus to aim. You use a trigger button to shoot. And you use either the nubbin or the face buttons, as I was using lefty with my right hand, to move your guy around. Awkward, certainly, but intuitive and makes a lot of sense and it works fairly well. And if the 3DS itself was a little larger in my hand, I wouldn't have the, you know, spina bifida of the hand that I got in attempting to do that, because just the trigger placement on the 3DS is just awkward and uncomfortable. But then you get to the ground. And now you are responsible for moving through the environment as well as all the other stuff you had been doing. So you still use the stylus to aim your weapon and shoot your weapon, which can be both a melee and a ranged attack. But you are also responsible for moving the camera to navigate around the environment. So swiping on with the stylus moves your camera, and you swipe and then tap to stop the camera from moving. So the game is throwing tons of enemies at you all the time and behind you in different ways. So you're constantly having to rotate around and figure out where they are, and they're smacking you in the behind because you're not looking the right direction. And
right.
And you're also – it has some really wonderfully smart, interesting, innovative ideas to bring to the table.
But yeah.
But it's just so awkward to get to them. Like, you know, if you don't shoot for a little while, it automatically charges your weapon to a charge shot. So you'll often want to release the trigger and, you know, time your shot so that you charge up. But just the pure awkward placement of my hand and in everything, I just sort of always just had to hold down the trigger because I would be dropping the freaking 3DS, which is why they give you the stand. Because
now mechanical issues aside, which it sounds like it's pretty hard to get past those for the ground running around and stuff. But
yeah.
But what they're trying to do with the actual gameplay, like say it were on a more familiar device that had controls that were manageable.
Awesome.
Okay.
So, dig it. So totally
really,
dig
it. Really all boils down to this is fucking awkward to play on.
It seems to me they could have done themselves such a service by just adopting the sort of God of War, we'll control your camera for the most part stuff.
Right.
You know, we'll put the camera in the position that makes the most sense for you and let you do everything else. Why do I have to be dealing with the camera when it is so awkward? And so it's kind of like the same thing I had with Epic Mickey.
Yep.
You know?
Hey, Jeff, have you talked to people before about how much work goes into just a camera, just a camera team to do those things?
I don't doubt it. But then I don't see why we needed this on the ground stuff to work this way. It needs to be completely redesigned. There's a lot of really, as I said,
I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying that maybe the reason is that it would have been such a development burden, or maybe they were using so many resources on the 3DS that they just didn't have the overhead in the processor to run the camera AI.
Maybe. I don't know.
Some of this, though, sounds like sort of baseline, like, you know, before you're anywhere near done, you're testing these mechanics out, and somebody along the line had to realize somewhere that, you know, putting your hand this way and using the stylus to do this and then, like, transitioning. I mean, I'm sure there's some people that are perfectly comfortable with it, but I haven't played it, but
you
it
know
sounds...
You think you're clever. You think you got it figured out. You think people adjust to it.
Right.
Especially if you're working on a game, you've been working on the game for, you know, several months, and it becomes very familiar to you, but that's because you're working on it all the time and you don't think about someone just having a natural play experience with it.
But then they add these like platforming sections that are so brutal, and you'll fall to a lower level where there's bad guys, or there's a sequence that's a really cool level. You're fighting Pandora, I think Pandora's box. Yeah, I think that's Pandora, who has this crazy sort of surreal thing where you're never sure what you're actually seeing is real or not. And there's a sequence where you're like going through a circular tube that where all the walls are rotating, and you have to jump from thing to thing without falling, or you die, or you get hurt until you die. And it's just so frustrating because I'm just battling the camera the whole time. It's ridiculous. And anyway, but there are really cool things. There's tons of weapons to collect, and they all are very different and very cool. I mean, wildly varied weapons, which is a really interesting thing for a Kid Icarus game. There is this awesome sort of difficulty mechanic where you're wagering. There's a scale that you can slide of how difficult the game is, and you can sort of wager your hearts that you've collected against how difficult you're trying to make the game. So you'll, you know, higher risk, higher reward, and it kind of, the game is constantly trying to challenge you to go higher on your difficulty level. But the consequence for dying in the level is that it knocks down your difficulty level. And if I died, I want to try again at the same difficulty level.
Right.
I don't want to have, in order to continue, I inherently lose some of the difficulty level.
Ozzy was not a fan of that.
How
are you going to get better, right? Because then you go back to the easy stuff, and then you finish that, and then you get into the hard side, and you die again, go back to the easy stuff.
Exactly. And there's certain doors that you can't open unless you're at a certain difficulty level. So if you don't get to that level before that part of the level before dying.
Did you
dying,
just wind up conflicted over the whole game? I mean, like, was the flying part worth it?
Yes. I had a blast with that. And I liked a lot of the game. Yeah. It's not super long. And there's lots
of... Well, it's surprisingly long because it goes well beyond what you thought it was going to go.
Yeah.
Cool. That's a cool twist.
There's a lot of unlockable things to do. I didn't try the multiplayer because I didn't know anybody else that was playing it. But
Ozzy, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that's who I know. Had Ozzy, but there's a lot of really really cool ideas there. They're just trapped beneath this awkward control structure that seems so stupid for them to stick with.
And did you try? Because one of the things, like I said at the beginning of this, to bring the circle back, is that Ozzy loved that he could change the controls and fix those to him. Now, if you hadn't been Lefty, do you think you could have found a sweet spot?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. I'd love to try that add-on piece that they're offering, the what is it called?
The circle pad,
yeah, for left-handed people. But the fucking device should have shipped with...
And batteries. Remember, you got to put a battery in there, too.
Yeah.
So as a super nice guy, I'm going to tell you... you are a super nice guy. I know you're a super nice guy. I'm going to tell you that I looked up, because I heard you say it, I was kind of cringed a little bit. You don't really want to say spina bifida.
Oh, is it bad?
It's really bad. Oh. Yeah. So apologies to anyone who might have been
affected. I apologize. I think it's a funny-sounding word, and that's the only reason I used it. But I apologize to everybody who has ever had it. And
deep apologies if anyone has been affected by that, because it's
pretty awful.
It's tragic, yeah. Sorry.
All right, so we bring down the show, Jeff. I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to make sure and say that because I didn't, you know, we would never intend to offend.
Never.
And I saw in your eyes that was not even a
thought.
I didn't know what it meant, and I looked it up.
Stupid thing to say.
So, sorry about that.
Not the last time I'll say something stupid.
Funny that Pandora's box is involved in this, because Pandora's box is what the fighters are all after, evidently, in Street Fighter Cross Tekken. Hmm. And, boy, talk about Pandora's boxes being open. Capcom has really stepped into it with the whole DLC on the disc issue this time. Now, this has been up before. One of the most interesting finds here is Cinema Blend. This is a site that does games as well. Found a response that Capcom filed with the Better Business Bureau to a complaint that's been filed against them. So for those who aren't familiar, if you file a complaint with the Better Business Bureau, they contact the company involved and offer them, I think, like 30 days to provide a response, which becomes record. And here's the response. Here's an excerpt from the response that has caused the uproar. While Capcom is sorry that some of its fans are not happy about the chosen method of delivery for the DLC, we believe this method will provide more flexible and efficient gameplay throughout the game's lifecycle. There's effectively no distinction between the DLC being locked behind the disc and available for unlocking at a later date, or being available through a full download at a later date, other than the delivery mechanism. How do you feel about this? It's ignited a firestorm, and
Wait, am I, this is basically an extension of that. Is DLC on the disc? You know, is that a problem?
So the issue then, so Jeff, the thing is that there are an additional 12 characters for Street Fighter Cross Tekken.
Right.
They are in the PSP version from the outset, so you get them as part of the game, and they are being released as DLC for the home console version, paid DLC. They were already on the disc, mm-hmm. and they are simply locked behind a paywall, and you have to pay for them to be unlocked on your 360 or PS3 versions. There was a complaint filed with the Better Business Bureau, and Capcom's response is that, hey, it's still DLC. So, you know, my immediate response to this is we've got to, we as gamers have to insist that publishers be upfront about how they're handling this additional content, and they need to, from their side, manage expectations and be clear about what they're talking about. You can't call it downloadable content if it's not downloadable content.
You call it unlockable content.
It's certainly your decision, publisher. If you want to put more on the – if you've decided that this game has this feature, and this feature as part of what you get for your $60 and then something else that we're going to finish and put on the disc but you're going to have to pay extra for, that's certainly your prerogative. But calling it DLC – Which, by the way, the name is downloadable content, and then having it on the disc to be unlocked is totally deceitful, and it's not right. It's not a good way of treating your audience and your fans. Now, you know, if we want to argue about like what should and shouldn't be in the game, I think that's up to anybody who's playing it to make that value decision. You know,
that's up for creative to decide and for marketing to fuck with, basically.
But I mean, and so I think that the problem is that there's so much anger over it being called downloadable content that then spills over into everything else that it sort of obscures that point. Which, I mean, the bigger discussion is what do we want? What do we expect for our $60 in the game? But that really is for the publisher to determine. I mean, it is up to them. They could put one character in the damn game if they want to. It's their game. Yeah. They're selling it. It's up to us to buy it.
Right.
And so I think this is as much a simple issue of how it's being termed and how it's being presented, causing so much of the uproar. But I am curious what you guys think.
And I agree,
then I have some of folks' thoughts here.
I agree 100% with what you said.
I do too.
Well, that's a very short discussion.
And you know, the alternative, the shitty alternative, is that we all just redefine how we feel about DLC. We all redefine, you know, if they're going to treat DLC not as downloadable content, we should just start thinking of it as unlockable content ourselves and decide whether we want to pay for that or not.
People are already voting with their wallets, or do you think that a lot more people like to bitch more than they like to actually like go, you know what? I am going to forego this piece of DLC, even though I kind of want it. I'm disgusted with the principle of how it's being delivered, or unlockable content, or whatever you want to call it.
The tough part of that question is that you're talking about the people who are upset are the core fans,
right,
and they want that content, and they are upset, but they're also they're going to buy it. And I find it really hard to sit on a like high horse and say, oh, well, you shouldn't buy it, because damn it, like, this is their hobby. This is what they love. They love the game. They want the content. So it's really tough because, yeah, it's super frustrating. It's especially irritating. I mean, this is like a worse storm. It's especially irritating when you think, oh, well, the Vita version has all these characters for the base price, which, by the way, is less expensive because it's a less expensive game. And now you want more from me.
Yeah, this particular scenario is particularly...
It's just a bad scenario.
Yeah, it's particularly bad.
I also think that if you put, from a publisher's perspective, if you put stuff behind the firewall of extra cash, you're likely – I would be very interested to see what the numbers are. But I would be surprised if a very large percentage of your fan base actually purchases it. I would be surprised if you're basically just limiting the game to this smaller version of the game for the majority of your audience.
But I think I think flip this around from a publisher's perspective. They probably look at it and say, okay, Street Fighter Cross Tekken.
You're saying from their perspective.
They're saying that they're going to sell as many copies as they're going to sell with the roster that's in it. And by the way, everything that they make from selling these extra copies is just juice. It's just extra revenue because there's no one out there who's deciding not to buy the $60 game because it didn't have these characters. But there are a number of people who have bought the $60 game that'll buy a character pack. And that's just extra money for them. So
well, the fucked up thing is when it's these competitive games like this or Modern Warfare or something where
if you want to participate in the online community, you're sort of required to continue purchasing the DLCs or else you're...
Well, to a degree. I mean, that's one of the reasons that people argued also that this content had to be on the disc is because it avoids that situation of you having to get a big download even if you didn't buy it. So let's say Jeff and I play and I want to play with one of the downloadable characters he doesn't have. He at least has the assets for that character on the disc so I can play him.
Right.
That's still kind of a...
It's interesting, but...
But like for map packs, for example, I think it works both ways, right? There are certain map packs that you have to buy to be able to access those maps, and then there are other, well, maybe not. Maybe that's just the only model there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me to do that, and it's all semantics, really.
It is all semantics. That's the problem.
All right, we're going to wrap her up with finishing moves, but I want to throw one thing out there just for a quick... This is the show finishing move for you guys. Rockman Blitz. Excited, not excited.
I was not clear. It's a controller game, not
so
a
Rockman
not
Blitz.
A
real quickly, so
game.
Rockman Blitz is the new Harmonix Rockman game that's coming out. It's going to be a downloadable game this summer. It'll have 25 songs with it, but it accesses every Rockman game song ever made. Which
awesome.
You, whatever
All
you
that,
bought,
everything you've said
whatever
so far
you bought,
is awesome.
Whatever you've ever had. It is no plastic instruments.
That's the part.
It's a single player game. If you play it with a controller, it's a two-button control scheme. It plays off of the old Amplitude sort of model where you're jumping from track to track and hitting notes in rhythm. So it's very much rhythm-oriented. You're hitting all your notes in rhythm, powering up the tracks, and trying to get all of them powered up at once, and then hitting high scores off of that.
Here's what I like about it. I like the idea of accessing an existing song base that they've already sort of sold out into the world. And making new game types that lock into that. I think that's cool. What I don't think is cool is playing a game of Rock Band with a controller.
Totally. You went first, but yeah, ditto. Yeah, that's the exact way I feel. I think the coolest thing about it for me is, as someone who occasionally powers that game up every once in a while, is the extra tracks.
25 more tracks, which we'll play with Rock Band 3, by the way. They did announce that also. The 25 tracks we'll play with Rock Band 3.
But, yeah, the actual game looks like a distraction, and it's really cool that they're leveraging that library, but, you know, it's a two-button arcade game that, you know...
Amplitude was awesome and totally fun, so I hope it works out. I would, depending on price point, I think, you know, as long as this thing isn't too expensive, because it's relying on you buying lots of DLC to play more songs, so it's another way for them to start, you know, selling more downloadable games. I mean, downloadable songs. All right, folks, let's do the finishing moves.
Finishing moves.
Jeff Cannata, finish them.
Okay, bear with me on this one. So this comes from playing Mass Effect 3 and using Kinect and my voice commands sort of at the same time as getting the new iPad, which has the sort of Siri-esque voice command stuff built into it. I'd never had the new iPhone to have Siri, so this is all... It's just starting to really see the potential of voice commands and getting really excited about it. I've started using my Kinect to control my Xbox more to, you know, just launch a game. I can sit there and scroll through a menu to find a game, or I can just say, hey, launch that game. Pretty cool. So let me down the road of thinking games should be controlled with voice. Thinking about Ryan's game where you are literally communicating to a person through touch in his case, but why aren't we moving toward communicating to a person through voice command? To the idea of the Kickstarter project of Double Fine and the idea that these old point-and-click adventures could be talk adventures. They were all about syntax anyway. Why not have put together a noun and a verb to do certain things for your guy on screen. Guybrush Threepwood would always talk back to you as if you were controlling him. It makes so much sense to have a voice controlled game. Why aren't we doing that?
Could you not teach people other languages that way too?
Amazing. Amazing. You just made that better. Amazing.
I love it when you get excited. He's like, you just made that better. You are the man. And Jeff Mattis, you are the man to finish this up next.
Okay, cool. So just a real quick PSA about Mass Effect. There's another N7 weekend this weekend. 75 XP bonus?
I think it's 25%.
25%.
But you can play whatever you want to.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's the difference. And then, but in order for this XP to reflect correctly in your game, you need to go into the online settings and make sure that upload gameplay feedback is set to enabled or on. which is really weird.
That's the way they get the feedback, so you get your rewards. And I found this out because I'm glad you said this, because I was a victim of this, because I did the first couple and didn't get rewards. And I was like, I don't know why I didn't get my reward box. And it's because I had turned that off. So if you don't give them gameplay statistics, then they don't know that you played. If they don't know that they played, you don't get your rewards.
Oh, just one more real quick unrelated thing. That Google Glass concept video is freaking awesome.
It was really cool.
So look it up.
I want that.
It's on YouTube. It looks, I want it now, please.
It's kind of uncomfortable, but yes.
Yeah.
So right now, if you are working, if you happen to be sitting there listening to this show and you're working on a mobile game for iOS platform or Android platform, perk up your ears for just a moment. I happen to be in a very fortunate position to be starting a new project at Gamefly and would love to talk to you about what you're working on and help you not have to starve yourself to death or look quite as haggard as, you know, seeing Ryan here. Like, this is stories we hear all the time. Basically, we're going to be doing some pub funding, and I've been working very closely with getting this thing put together. It's extremely friendly. We're not looking to be shitty people or take anything away from you. Just kind of help good games get made.
Yeah, reach out.
So give me a shout. It's Glee, G-L-E-E, at Gamefly.com. We'll now return you to your regularly scheduled programming. Hey, that's it, folks. Jeff... anything awesome on Totally Rad Show coming up this week?
I have tons of awesome stuff this week.
And rad stuff.
Also rad stuff. We'll have our in-depth Kid Icarus review. Lots of other goodness. Check us out. TotallyRadShow.com.
And, of course, ShackNews.com for your daily video needs. Oh, and watch the video show. Watch our new daily video show, which is daily every day except for Thursday, because we haven't figured out how to do a daily show on the same day we do the podcast. There's so much going on. I got to figure that out. Something else for me to figure out in my daily routine. All right, folks, that's it. That's your weekend confirmed. Until next week, we are Ghost. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Work so hard that you know we play harder. Yeah, come on. It took a minute for me to see what was going down. Body's vibrating, pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hear me with another round. I got a feeling she's ready. This podcast is brought to you by Random House Audio. Visit www.randomhouseaudio.com to download something new.